Executive Director. Actually, Mr. Ntlantlangidi will lead in detail of the presentation. Mine will be just to make final comments for closing before the questions from the committee members. It is with greatest appreciation to SALGA to be afforded an opportunity to present to the local government comments and position on this National Integrated Resource Plan, which is a key plan in outlining the country's future electricity landscape and how it will be implemented from various type technologies. South African municipalities play a vital role in the electricity sector, as the Constitution assigns the function to regulate electricity to local government. With the rise of electricity tariffs, as well as the technological advances on green energy and energy efficiency, consumers are reducing their electricity consumption and defecting from the municipal grid. This has led to a serious decline in municipal revenues. And this is a serious matter because the white paper of local government envisaged that the 60% of the municipal revenue will come from trading services. Now, then the issue of electricity is really the serious matter to local government. SALGA, with assistance of energy experts in the sector, embarked on internal consultation process through a number of workshops with municipalities and partners, with the objective to compile a detailed local government position to the IRP 2018. On the 25th of October 2018, SALGA submitted its detailed comments on the draft of IRP 2018. Now, this is our overview position, of which Mr. Ntlanta will then go to detail. Our priority requests as SALGA are that municipalities must be involved in the IRP planning process, including implementation thereof. This is coming from our comments from both the IRP 2016 and 2018 submission, as we as SALGA Energy Summit declaration early this year. There already exist a number of innovative municipal energy plans, along with vast range of knowledge and expertise which could assist in the process. The inclusion of local government in the planning process will contribute to a prudent plan which addresses crucial issues that may impact both on local government electricity services and the financial viability of local government. Lastly, SALGA is supportive of the notion that municipalities should be allowed to procure electricity from various sources other than ESCOM. The inclusion of municipalities in the planning and in the IRP planning and its implementation will ensure that they are able to positively respond to the energy transition already in their midst and affecting their business operations from the financial and technical perspective. I thank you. I'll then hand over but again, we'd also like to appreciate the Minister and the Department for substantial amount of work done between IRP 2016 and IRP 2018 with a few positive input. We'd also like to recognize some progressiveness in the latest plan. That will be my introductory remarks. I will then hand over to Mr. Nhlanhla Ngidi to go to the details on the technical aspect. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Councillor Nguban, and thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to the colleagues, members of the Portfolio Committee, and colleagues in the House. I am Nhlanhla Ngidi, as our National Chairperson has introduced me. I'm going to be taking you through the technical part of the presentation. Basically, the outline, I'm not going to go through it in the interest of time, but I'll just delve into the detail of the presentation. The first part of the presentation is just talking about, you know, just to give background around the relevance of the IRP to local government. If you look at local government, it's actually 40% of the demand nationally, and we actually supply 60% of the customers in the country, but 40% of the generation demand. And as Councillor in his introduction has already alluded to the fact that local government is an important aspect of the electricity supply industry. If you look at 40% demand of the whole generation of the country, that is quite substantial. If that 40% is not part of the RP, then it creates a bit of a challenge, Chairperson. I think what I on that profile, we're trying to project what has been the demand in that 40% that municipalities hold the demand. You can see that up until lately, which is 2017-18, the demand has been declining. But what we see on the RP is a very optimistic demand forecast, which is going up, which is a bit of a worry for us as local government, but I'll talk to that later. And I think on this slide, I'm just, you know, just alluding to the fact that, you know, the municipal finances and expenditure is very, very important for for municipalities, especially where electricity is concerned. And in summarizing this slide, the municipalities actually are expected to make a whole lot of money from electricity, and it is a reality that from electricity, municipalities gain a bigger percentage of the budget, and with this electricity and the changes that are happening at this point in time, we see a decline in those revenues, and in other municipalities, they are already on a negative already now. But with the metros, some of them are on the flat demand, and some of them are just, breaking even now and not even making surpluses. So I'm just trying to summarize without going through it in that slide. I think this is exactly what I was trying to project in terms of what is happening. If you look at, this is up until 2013. Unfortunately, we still putting together the data from 2014 until later. But if in 2014 already the decline in other municipalities has gone to negative, can you imagine 5 years later, which is from 2014 to 2018? And this is purely due to a number of factors, but one of them is the energy transition that is upon municipalities right now. The dynamics that are happening at local government, which we feel that at the IRP level, they are really not taken into consideration. We always, when we discuss with our colleagues from DOE, we always, raise that the 40% demand that is in local government, in the RP, it must not be seen as a black box, because the transition that is happening right now is actually taking place there at local government area, at local government level. The transition is impacting more at local government level and at distribution level. If you ask ESCOM now, where are their revenues mostly affected? they will tell you that it's at distribution, and that is where municipalities are actually operating as well. So the transition is happening more at distribution level, but the RP sort of looks at the distribution level as a black box, and this is why we're always trying to raise this with our colleagues from DOE. And I think this slide is just talking about the energy sector transformation. Chairperson and members, we hosted the SALCA and Energy Summit in March, where all of us, including ESCOM, Department of Energy, COSTA, and all stakeholders in the room, we all agreed that the electricity supply industry and distribution industry, as we know it, is no longer sustainable and is no longer viable for all sectors of government, not just local government. And I think in our declaration of that summit, there was an agreement that embracing this transition is no longer a choice, but a necessity. So we are raising that the RP really needs to look at this energy transition. So there's a changing landscape, obviously. Right now we are still sitting at centralized landscape, but maybe no longer. We are going towards decentralized type of setup. Consumers are actually becoming producers now. There's a new term called prosumer, where now consumers are actually taking responsibility of their own supply. And this is happening in municipalities, and these are paying customers in municipalities. So if the paying customers are actually now starting to create the decentralized situation in municipalities, what is happening is the municipalities is left with the poor customers, the non-paying customers, and even the customers that are stealing electricity. So this transition has a lot to do with what the RP must do going forward. So this is why we are, you know, beaming that slide, sensitizing the portfolio committee around the changes that are already happening. I mean, there are customers, a lot of them, we haven't quantified as the government how many of the customers, industries, have actually installed their own generation. That has happened without regulation. We have regulation in place now, and it's not going to stop. So we really need to take cognizance of the changes that are happening in the energy industry. I'm going to go straight into the transition, and that slide is just, outlining the kinds of internal consultation workshops we did at SALCA. We had three workshops with our members and our partners. We were collecting, some input from our members. But on the basis of these consultations, we have developed a very detailed document with our comments at SALCA Municipality. Which is going to be submitted before end of business today to the Department of Energy. So I'm going to go straight into the analysis of what we've seen in the modeling process. And again, Chair, I want to go back. Before I introduce, I wanted to say we are not here to criticize the RP. The RP, there's a lot of work that has happened, that is taking place in the RP. What we are here to do is actually to enhance the work with the input, the positive input that you want to make in the RP. So we're not here to criticize and not give solutions or recommendations. That is not what we're here to do. There's a lot of work that went into this plan. So as SALCA and local government, we want to make input that affects local government that could enhance the process of developing the RP. So first, I think we're going to talk about how we analyze the modeling process. In terms of this RP, the modeling solved for the lowest cost of power, but it's only to the ESCOM meter terminals. And this is going back to what I was saying, that the 40% that is the demand in municipalities is looked at as a black box, as, you know, that is just an ESCOM meter, and beyond that, nothing is happening. But this is very dangerous, Chairperson. It's almost half of the demand of the country. Massive coefficients of the dynamics that are happening there. So we are saying that this modeling, maybe it does not really ensure net cost to consumers. And If it's not in this cost, you know what it means for consumers, actually high electricity tariffs. And Chairperson, we have looked at this model, it's not a limitation. What you're talking about is not a limitation. It's something that the model can do. There's another input also that, no, the model must determine what generation source and when is needed. But in the modeling that is done in ARP 2018, it's not really accounting for where the generation should be. And we know that what that means for the price of electricity. Chairperson, I see your expression, so I'm going to explain this again. the model that is used to determine what generation source, what technologies, and by when it's needed. But in the current modeling, it does not account for where the generation should be in the system, in the country. So this is not also a limitation for the model. The model can do that. I'm going to make one example. If we had to look at this aspect of the modeling where we are now making it an input for each to give results of where the generation should be, it could actually even help the country to choose where the cheap generation could be procured, where the infrastructure is in terms of transmission. Because, you know, at a later stage when we're trying to implement the RP, we might be actually looking at areas without a grid, or where the grid is too far, and you know what actually that means for the connection charges, and thereby the tariffs to the customers as well. So also, the model does not optimize distribution utility costs, so it's still at the 40% demand, not optimizing the distribution utility costs, and it rather assumes constant for the distribution utility costs. And we recognize, Jefferson, that the RP is not intended to govern the structure of the electricity industry. However, it must take the industry development into account. There's a worldwide trend of going from centralized in a type of setup in the industry to decentralized type of setups. So the inputs we are making, we're saying the RP could more accurately reflect the changing landscape in the energy sector, potentially reduce the cost of electricity supply to the end users to make it more least cost, show where the generation could be and when, so that we are able to analyze how expensive is that generation going to be for the end customer. And also it could include the generation options that could reduce ESCOM's charges to municipalities on notified maximum demand. So a lot can happen in municipalities around generation as well, where the municipalities could offset these charges and even the tariff, the ESCOM tariff, by having their own generation or even procuring from other cheaper sources. Also include generation options that could reduce distribution infrastructure costs and also improve security of supply to customers. So if the modeling was done more accurately, this is what you could get. I remember in the previous slide I was trying to raise some of the issues, some of the shortcomings, but now we are saying, you know, these are the solutions that can actually be put in place so that the security of supply is improved and also even the affordability for customers. But I'm still going to make more recommendations at a later stage in the presentation. In terms of the demand forecast, Chairperson, I think let's spend a bit of time on this one. This is RP 2016. If you look at the demand forecast, this is actual consumption. You know, the actual demand, look at the actual demand, the blue line. It's actually declining. It's been declining. But even the worst scenario, of the demand forecast in 2016 was still projecting going up. So we have to take cognizance of the accuracy in the forecast. Because if we are actually projecting high demand or high demand forecast, the model or the system of the model will tell us we need more generation. And when we take the decision as government to have more generation, we find ourselves having more stranded assets that the customers, us, all in this room must pay. But I'm going to, this was just 2016, I'm now going to 2018. If you look at the 2018 electricity consumption history in 2018 demand projection, you look at the first line from 1991 up until 2017, there is a decline, there is still a decline. Eskom sales are declining, municipal sales are declining. It means the demand is not there. Customers are being energy efficient, they are installing their own generation. But what are we seeing in the ARP 2018? We see a demand that is forecasted on a higher level. So I think in my previous slide, what I left also is the growth of the GDP. The GDP was pretty much flat. The actual consumption was flat. Let me go back to that slide, Jefferson. If you look at the GDP, it was growing very slowly. It had become almost becoming flat. The actual demand was declining, but the demand forecasts were actually going up. And as I said and emphasized, even the worst scenario in the model was still very optimistic. This is still emphasizing our case. This is what electricity sales are in the metros at this point in time. No growth at all, Jefferson. The metros are actually 65% of the 188 municipalities who are supplying electricity. If I say 65%, it means their demand is 65% of the 40%. This is what is happening, only 65% of the 40%. And yet, we still look at that 40% as a black box. I'm even making a case about Eskom sales. They are flat and declining. Look at the industry, it's declining. Mining, flat and declining. In municipalities, it's flat. And the reason why it's flat in municipalities is because there is decline in demand in municipalities themselves, and they are the consumers of the Eskom bank electricity. So you are bound to have that kind of situation even with Eskom sales. Where also there are a bit of concerns from us when you go to multi-year price determination. You see Eskom doing exactly what is done in the RP, where they're projecting too much sales. We don't know when they're going to get them. So, Jefferson, I'm just emphasizing the point of the declining sales here. Now, in terms of concluding on the demand forecast, so this demand, this high demand forecast is a potential to create stranded assets, I did say that, and this will drastically increase the price of electricity, and it will further exacerbate the financial difficulty in municipalities and Eskom. We all know municipalities are owing Eskom almost 14 billion, but if this is going to be the situation, we're creating more assets centrally on generation, it means the tariffs are still going to be very high. And you know what happens in municipalities where they are actually supplying the poorest of the poor customers. It means for them, no money is going to be coming, and more money is going to be owed to Eskom. And also, just to talk about the forecast, they must reflect the current situation, experience on the ground. So include that 40% and the dynamics within that 40% in how you do your demand. If your metro, 65% of them, has energy plans and they are telling you that in these energy plans our forecast is flat because our industry is doing energy efficiency and they are putting their own panels and they are doing their own gas turbines, then also within this plan must be affected. So I'm not going to talk through this last bullet because it's still emphasizing that, you know, in their forecasting, municipalities don't do optimistic forecasting because they know what is happening. They know what is happening looking at their revenue. They know what is happening looking at how much bulk supply they buy at Eskom. In terms of the lease cost, SALCA welcomes the major improvement in the lease cost technology choices in the RP. In comparison to the previous plan, and also we know that the RP is an infrastructure development plan. It must be based on the least cost supply, but we know, Jefferson, the government is competing, you know, priorities. If we know that least cost plan is wind and solar, But because of competing priorities from government, you have to still save those coal jobs. So there are other dynamics in the economy that forces government to take policy directions that are actually going away from being difficult. And it's understandable, it's the competing priorities from government. You have a target of increasing employment, and your target is not to decrease employment as government. So we understand those dynamics. But I think we should strike a balance. While we are trying to save those coal jobs, but also strike a balance that we're not making electricity to be more expensive due to, you know, continuing in building the bigger assets through, you know, your coal. Also, municipalities acknowledge the job protection and rotation related to coal-fired power. Okay, I did allude to that. So I can just move to the next slide. Let's talk about storage technologies as well. In terms of the RP has used, the model has used the constant technology price for storage. But it doesn't reflect the recent trends or the future predictions, where the costs are expected to decrease by 70% by 2030. So if you look at this chairperson, storage can actually reduce the amount of gas we need, because gas also is very expensive. We understand that gas should be there as flexible generation to cover for renewables when they are not in the system, because coal-fired stations are not flexible. You need gas, you need more flexible generation, but it's expensive. Because we don't have natural gas in the country, we use diesel. And diesel is very expensive. So look at the storage. The storage now is we have bigger storage batteries, source is free, sun, or the radiation, supplemented with some of the gas there, and you might not really need that much gas in the system. But obviously, have a look at it, do the studies, vis-a-vis the actual decrease in the price. Don't assume that the price of storage will be constant until 20 days. I think on embedded generation, this slide is from City of Cape Town, and it's presenting the changes that are happening due to technological advancements in the municipalities. Already, if you look at that profile, today in City of Cape Town, we have almost 15 megawatts that is accounted. I'm going to say accounted because there are people who are doing this without telling the municipalities. The municipalities have seen a reduction in the use of electricity. There are people who just put these panels just as an energy reduction kind of an idea for them or initiative. So these changes are really happening. This is just City of Cape Town. As SALCA, we do have also a database that gives us the numbers of where embedded generation is happening and how much of it do we have. So within this space of 40% chairperson, there is a lot of dynamics happening, especially when it comes to generation, especially when it comes to supply options by customers. So we welcome the inclusion of embedded generation as we think this is progressive. But 200 seem to be very small. There have been no studies that have been done to show where the 200 come from. You know, were there any analysis studies that were done to show why do we have to limit this to 200 megawatts? At this point in time, chairperson, the Department of Energy has 1,500 megawatts, or should I say the minister has 1,500 megawatts of application that he should make determination for. They are at distribution level, 1,500 megawatts, 1.5 gigawatts. And look at the plan, what it's allowing, 200 megawatts per year until 2030. Already the minister is putting 1,500 megawatts of the generation that he should be doing. So maybe this is not an observation that is educated, but this is why we need those studies that show why did we limit that to 200 per year, why the dynamic or the reality is showing otherwise. We have to figure out around it. It must not come across as we have just said the number. It's not what I'm saying, but it should not come across as that. So there are numbers that we are thinking about, but I think at this point in time, we said the Department of Energy should look at this determination that is sitting on their table. There are municipalities already that want to procure 300 megawatts in 1 year alone. So that 200 megawatts chapter is not for municipality. That's one other thing that we have to clarify. It's not for municipality. It includes private sector, it includes customers, and then municipalities. So this is the cake is shrinking smaller and smaller. When we have a couple of metros and secondary cities that already have a few projects in the pipeline where they want to build or even procure. So I think in summary here in this slide, we say maybe let's do the study. You know, we as Salga, we're not that kind of institution that criticize and try to be part of the solution. We are willing to work with the Department of Energy to do those kind of studies with the input that our metro and the expertise that the metros have also around it. In terms of the climate change, we know the current RP needs the energy for climate change, but you know, we know that nationally the determined contributions are very conservative, and we need to have more drastic actions around maintaining the global warming to be below 1.5°C. Now I'm going to go to the proposals, which is coming towards the end of our presentation. For 2018, this is like the short-term proposal. There must be a reduced demand in the model. It must be almost accurate. It will not be accurate, but it must talk to the region. Unless maybe DOE and the government are aware of something that maybe will not come down, the growth that is coming quite soon after. In 2018 also, we must use accurate price forecast for battery storage. As I said, by 2030, there will be a reduction of about 70% of price of storage. But I don't think it will be by 2030 will be reduced by 70%. We still how fuel is actually increasing. So when we have those gas turbines, by 2030, we'll have diesel liters that might be costing 40%. Vis-a-vis having storage that might be even less because the technology might be less pricey. There's no primary energy, all natural. Also, Salga suggests outstanding 1,500 megawatts, awaiting minister's determination to be tackled as a starting point to the embedded generation after allocation, and also to do future studies to investigate if the limit on this generation is really necessary, if it can provide a benefit to municipalities and their customers. Also, we have to develop an IRP scenario with more ambitious greenhouse gas, right? And reduce carbon. In terms of now, maybe medium to long-term recommendations, as far as we ask for active collaboration between the national government and local government in the IRP process, obviously, I can't stress it any longer. That's almost half of the demand in the municipality. We must have the whole country in the country. So we need to have collaboration with local government. Include local government in the planning process and implementation thereof. There are already a number of innovative municipal energy plans with draft knowledge and expertise that can improve the planning process as well. And also, there could be investment in local government that can offer options for generation and energy savings solutions. In terms of the modeling process, we recommend that it should optimize the discourse to the point of the consumer, not to the point of the ESCOM. Because the point of the estimator is still a municipality. So it should go straight directly to the end customer, that discourse. And also to allow, by allowing the model to better reflect the changes in the landscape, it could lead to better and lower cost customer services instead of incentivizing a crisis. And also demand forecast should include the different uptake rates of distributed technologies, the demand side management initiatives and the energy efficiency initiatives, and also the storage of electric vehicles and their impact in the demand curve as well, that should be taken into consideration. And also, studies should inform in the most beneficial location for the plant, as I said, Jefferson, at distribution level and also at transmission level. Excuse me, the availability of the location of generation and availability of the grid is quite vital in the pricing of electricity. Also, studies should inform, regular updates on the RT needs to take place. I think this is already happening, but it could be more regular than every 2 or 3 years. And in terms of future research, there needs to be tariff impact studies and wholesale price test development for the different RP scenarios, including increased gas, greenhouse gas emission scenarios and further sterile effects on demand. This is crucial to assess and the most suitable options, as tariffs can be the driver of demand. Chairperson, there is, I think I passed the slide where I want to stress a point as well. We need to ensure that the model makes the implementation of the RP to be very, very important. Because even with the generation that we have now, we have ESCOM that has already 4% increase that they got from a regulatory clearing account. It's going to be implemented for the next 4 years, 5 years. ESCOM in MIPD4 is asking for 15%. What does this mean? It means that while they are asking for the 15%, they are carrying a 4% surety. So if they get the 15%, they get 19%. And there's a DBSA study that has looked at this increase in tariff and how it will affect the economy. And at this point, the study we can share it actually pronounced 685,000 jobs that will be lost if ESCOM were to get this 19% for the next 3 years. And in actual fact, it's not going to be 19% because MIPD allows regulatory clearing account. So even the MIPD4 will have regulatory clearing account. You could see this going to 25-30%. And thereby means it's no longer 685,000 jobs that will be lost. It could be more. So these are other research that things should be done small scale embedded generation. Also capture the amount of the power capacity that is being installed in this embedded generation. Ensure registration database, which I think the DOE is working with NERSA at this point in time. Understand the extent to which systems are being used to reduce demand and how much is being fed back to the distribution grid. So I think within the regulation on embedded generation and licensing regulation, that is currently what is happening. But I think we had to emphasize this here, Chairperson. Lastly, municipalities are supposed to better engage with the changes in the energy landscape to ensure a sustainable, affordable service provision to their customers, and also determine electricity usage and demand forecast to feed into the RP. Obviously, as I said, there are measures that have their energy plans, but there are municipalities that will need support to actually be able to have their energy plans that could make substantive input into the RP process. Also, in procuring electricity that will ensure the least cost to their customers, This could come in the form of energy plans. And lastly, Jefferson, municipalities need a conducive policy environment that allows them to embrace the transition in the energy industry. I think with that, Chair, that will be the end of our presentation. We thank you again for the opportunity. I don't know if my Chairperson. Thanks. Thank you, Chairperson. We'll take questions.
Concerning the work, nothing to say. Are you happy?
Yes, that is our submission.
Thank you very much, Father. Honourable members, any questions? Questions of clarity. And I'm asking this question because I've been told Salga delegation has asked to leave after the implementation. I don't know where they're going, but we have already acceded to their request. So can we, if there are any questions of clarity? Okay. It seems not. So let's do this. Mr. Court. I'm sure we can make the decision now. We're a member of the National Executive Committee of SALGA. We can make the decision now. I think in 2 weeks' time we will finalize the report of the public hearings. Please accept this ambush. On Tuesday the 30th, we're having what we call a round table discussion on the RP based on the submissions we've received. So a few stakeholders will come, including DOE and ESCOM. So it is quite clear to us now, having looked at the presentation, that SALGA plays a central role. So will you please come on Tuesday?
Definitely will have to come.
Thank you very much. So we have heard what we have had to say. So we'll engage more with you on the issues we have raised on Tuesday when we come. So we want to have a more focused conversation on Tuesday on all the things that have been raised over the 5 days of the public hearings before we finalize our report to the House and the copy that we'll submit to the DOE. Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate your input, so we'll take the next presentation.
Thank you.
Ms. B. Martin, are you ready? Okay. I think we have copies of your presentation. You can start while Mr. Port is trying to address the problem with the project. So please go ahead.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson, members. I'm Brenda Martin. I'm with the South African Wind Energy Association. The association represents the South African wind industry, and we have about 96% of our members are companies working in the wind energy value chain in South Africa. In this presentation, I will take you through the sort of outline of, first of all, what it is that wind is contributing, what it is that our industry is aware of in our context that we work within, and also what it is that we are able to contribute into the future, particularly as this relates to different planning choices that are made. We question the assumptions around coal in particular, and we demonstrate what could happen if the current RP is taken up with the procurement gap in place that we have. And then lastly, we make recommendations around two recommendations that I will talk you through very briefly at the end. And that is the gist of what I would have to cover. So I'm going to skip over the initial part. This microphone, I've spoken about what SWEA does. The concerns that we are aware of as an association, you will have heard many times that the renewables industry is made up of a large number of foreign investors. Is also a view that a lot of the money that is acquired within this industry leaves the country. These are things that can be checked fairly quickly when you look at the Department of Energy's reports around how the industry is structured. So when an investor comes to South Africa, this is the kind of information that we as an association make sure that they understand, that there's an historically dominant, coal-dominant economy that we operate within, that there's a paradigm shift around a decarbonized economy that needs to happen, and that there are legacies of a minerals energy complex that are very, that go throughout our economy, and that it is necessary to consider the socioeconomic issues relevant to the transition. It is vital and it's foreground of even with our planning. That is the kind of information we make sure that our members are informed of. The wind power at the moment contributes 52% of renewables overall, so it's a significant participant in the current transition and is leading the transition towards a great share of renewables. The IEA has forecast that we will be contributing 40% of the share of power that is produced by 2022, but that's the global picture. The South African energy transition is very much a primary driver of the RRP. It sets the RRP 2010 sets an investment pathway for that transition, and we are still trying to deal with that. Why I mention this is that it is quite fundamental to what the current update is trying to achieve. How true is it to those at that original purpose? And we are seeing some connections and some disconnections that we are concerned about. In the long term, the RRP is meant to consider long-term objectives, and from a wind energy industry, we are quite happy with the long-term outlook that the RRP supports. But in the short term, there are some serious problems for the industry. And when you take into account that government needs to consider short and long term, it can't provide more support for a long term view, for instance, and neglect short term imperatives. So the two concerns that we have are all relevant to the procurement gap which exists for renewable energy in the RRP at the moment. There is a self-start procurement which will inevitably come out of what is in the plan at the moment. This is bad for employment and for local manufacturing sector growth in particular. I'll focus on these two issues in my presentation. To give you a sense of the employment effects, we have just seen over the last 2 years with the PPA impact, you're all aware of the fact that Eskom had refused to sign the procured PPAs over the last 2-3 years. That resulted in manufacturing facilities having to close. So one wind tower manufacturing facility is in Kuka in Nelson Mandela Bay. It is closed, and it's still closed. It is trying to reopen, but it will not reopen if there's a procurement gap in the RRP. And that is a facility that can employ hundreds of people. So that's quite an important part of understanding the employment effects of the current draft RRP. Then there's a sudden spike in new commissioning of new renewables in 2026, and this means that the industry is somehow meant to revive itself from having had no orders for 3 years to being able to produce quite a lot of demand in a short space of time. This is an illustration of that gap, this is what happens when we go with the draft RRP as it stands at the moment. And this is just for construction. You would have no construction work that is able to be undertaken during those 3 years that are indicated there, and you suddenly need to have a large number of construction workers found in order to achieve the spike in demand in the year 2026. For operations, and this is operations and maintenance, when you have the power plants running and you've got staff that are working from offices in different metros, or you've got maintenance staff who are moving around from one plant to another, even in the operations phase, there's a flat employment effect of the procurement gap. So the growth can go up as long as there's demand linked to procurement. By contrast, it's worth noting that at the moment, the DOE's last report in March 2019 confirmed that 1,883 people were employed by the operational renewables project. That is equal to 16% of Eskom's, the people employed by Eskom generation. we only produce, the renewables industry as a whole only produces 4% of the power. So this means that the renewables industry is currently four times as employment intensive as Eskom is. So that is quite important to bear in mind. We are able to offer some jobs, and we're able to offer some significant jobs, not necessarily the level of work that you could get from coal mining, but certainly in terms of generation, we're making a significant contribution. This area of procurement gas is going to undermine government's commitment to creating a local manufacturing sector. And I'll speak about the localization agenda in the renewables program. REAP, as it's referred to, has in round four, local content commitments were between 45% and 65%. That's the requirements that were there. In order to achieve local content, you have to have a local industry. And a local industry that is not only investing for 2 years, because you can't build a massive wind tower manufacturing facility which costs hundreds of millions to build, and then say that for 2 or 3 years you must now close your doors and wait until the procurement starts up again. So those kinds of things are really relevant to consistent procurement. The wind industry has invested $725 million in local manufacturing capacity. That's the two facilities, the one in Atlantis in the Western Cape and the other one in Kuka. And as I mentioned, the Kuka one is still closed. There's a steel manufacturing plant, so we also have a steel demand within the industry, and we have a concrete and construction demand. And then, of course, there's a transport demand. All of these are sort of secondary employment benefits. But direct employment, we have created 1,179 full-time manufacturing jobs. That's just within the manufacturing sector. That's not taking into account the steel, concrete, and construction jobs. So I think just on the basis of the $725 million, that's what we were able to achieve with jobs. By having this gap in the RP, we feel that short to medium term risks are associated. There's a loss of at least $750 million in further manufacturing investment, because there is with a regular demand, we would have further investment that could be made. There's a loss probably of the existing jobs, if we don't take into account future prospective jobs. And there's a lot, the CSIR in our written submission, which I sent to the committee, we showed CSIR research that points out that 53,000 direct manufacturing jobs would not be brought forward. They could be brought forward if that gap is smoothed out. So this refers to the written submission. And then there's a lot of benefit to the economy of growing domestic wind industry. And when I speak to investors who are wanting to come here, besides the towers, as you get more allocations in the RP, you can then have the blades being manufactured locally, you can have the nacelles being manufactured locally. These are all the different parts of the wind turbine that could be produced here, and these are all job-intensive industries. They're not industries that are highly mechanized. So I think it's important to bear that in mind. So we recommend that the RP update should be adjusted to smooth out and accelerate procurement, so that you have around 5 being announced next year, for instance, in the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Program. We are happy with the allocation of 8,100 megawatts, which works out to about 900 megawatts per annum. We'd like that just to be raised to 1,000 megawatts. It's not a big ask, we believe. And we would like that the market risks associated with stop-start procurement are really taken seriously, especially given that we want to create jobs, not lose more. The second recommendation is to rerun the RP1 scenario and to reconsider coal-related investment costs, to realistically consider Eskom's fleet availability. The data will be available very soon, if not next week. This should have quite a significant effect on when we should have our next rounds of procurement. And bear in mind, it takes 2 years to build out wind farms. It's not a long process, and so you have very little risk of running over budget. And if there is a budget overrun, the private sector has to carry that, nobody else. There's also, I think, value in considering the fact that the like Salga has just mentioned, the fact that this transition is underway and that people are starting to shift to electric vehicles, they're starting to consider demand side flexibility, especially in the light of electricity tariffs. And then there is a need to consider to speed up the decommissioning of coal plants, not in isolation, bearing in mind that with those jobs that will be lost, there's got to be a parallel set of very definite social support structures that are put in place, and the wind industry is willing to participate in that and offer some options to people who are losing jobs. And we think if that is done, that the model findings will favor very different allocations annually for wind. I want to say that ultimately, so this is the kind of scenario that we are asking for consideration of, so that you have a smooth allocation over time rather than the kind of erratic gap that is very alarming. In conclusion, I want to say that, you know, all renewable energy is solar. It all comes from the sun. Ultimately, you know, we dry our washing, we do all kinds of things by relying on the sun. It's a critical source. Wind is a very effective way to harness that resource. It's the most cost effective, and it's one that also ends up benefiting all these other sectors within South Africa's economy. So if you think about different options from a least cost perspective, from a job creating perspective, and from also land use, that you can still farm around the turbines, these are all the ways in which we can make a very good contribution to South Africa's energy and socioeconomic growth. So we believe that we are not asking for a wild and unrealistic contribution to be made by the industry. We are saying that we can make something that is meaningful and appropriate to South Africa. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Why didn't you clear about that self-presentation? I think these recommendations have been made since last week, so they are consistent with what other people in the renewable energy space are saying. Where is Mr. Mbele? Okay, the Deputy Judge, Director General responsible for education, so we'll have a discussion next week. I've heard him respond to this proposal for smoothing out, which appears to me to be the most critical thing among the things that have been said by people, stakeholders in the renewable energy space. So we'll return to it next week. Otherwise, thanks a lot. The only thing I liked is that it was short. I don't want to comment on the content. I'm more interested in meeting my deadline of 1 o'clock. Okay. Can we just energy? Are you ready? Welcome. Go ahead.
Nkosi Sihlalo, maziyithethe into yoba from uJust Energy Future Campaign siyalibulela eli thuba kuwe njengosihlalo wasigqeba nakunye nakumalungu akho ekomiti sithi enkosi. I think if you look into the next slide, there is a big background of, a brief background of the Just Energy Future Campaign. And this campaign was formed in 2006 in the Nelson Mandela Foundation, based on many occasions, and with number of organizations within the civil society. And I believe they have also been called to make some presentations and submissions in here. And yeah, we'll comment around their submissions and as well as their oral presentation as we conclude this oral presentation. Yeah, let me head straight to the next slide, which is the understanding is that the integrated a resource plan 2018 as per government is to ensure the security supply, minimize cost of electricity, and minimize environmental impacts, and minimize water usage as well. Therefore, in that background, the Just Energy Future has noted some few elements in that regard. And one of the elements that we...
Yes, Chair, I'm sorry for interruption, but I don't know who is talking because I did not hear him introducing himself and his team. I'm sorry for go back to the introduction. Honorable Mabunda didn't hear you introduce yourself.
And then Fang and I'm about to listen.
Honorable Mabunda didn't hear you introduce yourself, so can you please go back to the introduction?
Okay. My name is Sibusiso Owen Didi. I work for a campaign called Just Energy Future Campaign, which is a campaign that looks to the energy future of the country and also allow a platform of engagement within the civil society, and also in terms of policy making, yes, across the board, and also do some research as such. I'm with my colleague, which is Thule Ngubane, who is based in Johannesburg and based in the Eastern Cape, but we work together for the campaign. Thank you. So as the campaign, we have submitted the submissions through the secretary, and also we requested this opportunity, which was granted to us. And as I indicated previously, that we are thankful for that. So as we are looking at the plan itself, we have noted some few elements which we think that the committee should consider and ensure that whenever there is these processes, these are being attended to. The publication of the RIP itself, the accessibility of it, because we have an experience in more especially in Mpumalanga and Limpopo,
where people could not be in a position to interpret the document itself in one of the meetings that we had, because they felt that the language is too technical for them to understand. So those were one of the things that we have noted. Secondly, it's the second issue, a meaningful way to seek not to include the most affected people. That's one of the things that we noted. I've also indicated the issue of the plan being technical, and it's difficult for ordinary people to engage in such, not to comprehend such. Yeah, we believe that the process is trying to be transparent as much as possible, but I think also much work needs to be done in that field, and more consultation, in particular where people are, because not everybody would manage to come and sit here and make their presentations. In terms of the plan itself, we have acknowledged that the energy mix 2020-2030 has not included nuclear. However, it's not clear what happens after that, which is 2030. So that is why we're saying, as the campaign, keep an eye on the proceedings and ensure that the space that has been created for us as a campaign to engage, the committee will continue engage in that process so that we make a meaningful deliberations and the process, we believe it will be transparent to allow that space. Also, we've also noted the inclusion of coal in the plan, and we think that it shows that the government is not committed to renewable energy and not to just transition. And I sure you know that as the committee, that the government of South Africa itself has made some commitments. Among other those commitments is the Paris Agreement, which talked to our greenhouse gases that needs to be reduced dramatically. So, going forward, there are many of those that has been signed, and believe that this plan should be subjected to those agreements. I think let me highlight the issue also of the Taiwan in Limpopo, the Chinese the loan that has been given to that province, to Taiwan. The lack of drinking water currently is becoming a concern. Whenever there will be a coal mine, one would take that into cognizance, and one also will take lessons from what has been happening in Pelindaba. And so I think this process needs to be a process that will seek to address a number of issues that we've made mistakes, or you made mistakes as government, so that we don't fall into that trap again going forward. Talking to, I think, a number of communities, including the former workers of the National Energy Corporation of South Africa in Pelindaba, they are a living example of what has happened during the Pelindaba issue. I think one of the things that the campaign has also called on not to recognize is to decentralization of energy systems. And we believe that the energy system must not look at industrial growth only, but also as in an aspect of human development as such, and consider the environment more than anything else. There should be a need also for a flexible approach to energy planning, and we're saying that one of the issues for us to recognize that the RIP is necessary to determine if the mining planning is aligned to the national development goals as well. Another proposal that we were putting on the table is that every 2 years this plan must be reviewed, just to ensure or just to assess if we are still in the same Are we in the right direction? Yes. I think there is an issue of transparency on IPPs as well. That has been noted by the campaign. I think no pronouncement has been made thus far by the minister in that regard, and we feel that the public needs to know if these RIPs will take a path which is more favorable to communities, to the development of our people to the core. Because we are as one of us, Bafuchani, have so been now Gnosis.
Not everybody understands Xhosa tribe speak to. I was happy to be about a slab, but I can move about.
I think, what I was trying to say was, sorry for that. What I was trying to say was, I have noted the issue of time as well. That is why within our delegation you will see us being the short basis, myself and my colleague. In that notion, let me conclude by saying, as I indicated previously, that we acknowledge the opportunity, but we hope and pray that this opportunity is not only a ticking box exercise. We hope and pray that this opportunity is not for steps as well. And in that same breath, we also, in support of the submissions and oral preservation which has been made here by SESFI, by F-Life Africa, by Groundwork, and Project 90 as well. So in that breath, Chair, I would give 2 minutes to my colleague for her to wrap things up. Thank you.
Thank you. Molweni bethu. Molweni yazwa msinya. Igama lam ndikuthula ngubane owenese chief. I think one of the things esenze into basize apha or sifuna ukwenza i-oral submission is the fact that you know, nathi sazi like gave space for China to about Yabo, Lende RP and all of that. And so to go back to the members, the campaign, and try and break down this IRP that was not even accessible in the first instance, because through EF Life we had requested copies, hard copies of these things, of the IRP, so that we are able to summarize it in a language and that, you know, the grassroots organizations that we work with can better understand. And so this has not happened, and I think that's one of the big issues that we've had as a campaign, to say that, you know, a conversation about this IRP must not only just be confined to these big boardrooms that we sit on in, but also it must trickle down to, you know, the most affected, because climate change is affected so long, and the IRP speaks to some of these things that contribute to climate change. Or when they mentioned coal, and or at least our stance on coal, opposition on coal and nuclear, and I reiterate a lot. But we just, one of the things that we're calling for is for like a meaningful public consultation where, you know, communities are going to be taken into the confidence of this, of the Energy Department and these processes, so that all voices are represented. We didn't come here to represent anyone, but we, you know, we have 60 organizations that are part of the campaign, that are members of the campaign, that really feel strongly that, you know, there could have been a meaningful process here. But also one of the things that we try with SIG to do is to give a human face to some of these things. When it's talk of coal and its impact on environment and health, you know, we're not just talking about is this partisan, you know, we're talking about we sit with women because, I mean, we know that women from low-income communities are the ones that bear the brunt of the decisions that are taken in these big boardrooms around coal, nuclear, and all of these things that, you know, compromises our environment. And so when we, so when I speak standing on the shoulders of these women who are saying, you know, that their health is affected, that they, it's hard to take care of their families and all of these things. When I speak here, I speak standing on the shoulders of the ex-Nexa workers who work at Pelindaba, who are exposed to radiation, who have been neglected, and no one is willing to focus on their stories and how it has affected them. They are dying slowly and no one is paying attention to them. And I know that this process is seeks to speak to the IRP, but some of the decisions that are taken or, you know, some of the recommendations you're given here, you know, will speak, will have an impact on low-income communities and these workers that are exposed to radiation, to coal dust and all of these things. So when we stand here, we stand on the shoulders of these black women and black communities that are sidelined in this process that will feel the impact of all of these decisions that we take here. With that, we'd like to thank the chair, Dr. Matola, and the members and everyone here for being allowed the opportunity to give some kind of contribution to this process. It may not be technical, but we're trying to bring in the human face, and thank you.
Thank you very much. And thanks, Honourable Fag, for attending me.
Owen and Putin, it's from Ben.
Okay.
Yeah, he speaks this event, so I'll put him.
Okay.
I think you got confused by Machol. It was a long Machol, so.
No, don't be confused. I hear you very well, but I appreciate the protection by Honorable Fab. Okay, two things, because we're not at the point of question and answer session now. Two things. Many people have come here and asked us if this is just an academic exercise or if we're just ticking the box. The answer is no. Second, the Earth Life came here and all people working together with F-Life raised this issue about the request they made to the department. The Director General of Energy was here. We asked him about this specific letter. He said that he would go and investigate what happened, why there was no response to the email of F-Life. He has since written a letter to me. We'll send it to F-Life. Okay. Because you just raised the matter. So he says, among other things, that because we asked F-Life not to repeat this thing. We asked them, but do you still need the copies that you asked about 2 months ago? So he says that, let me read from his letter, which the secretary is sending to his Kala of the flag. To remedy the situation, the department will issue to a flag the requested 100 copies and indicate that they have until end of November 2018 to provide written comments direct to the department. I will send this letter to her. Thank you. Sabule. National Society of Black Engineers.
Good morning, colleagues. I'm Ndum Laba, the president of the National Society of Black Engineers. I'm joined by Ms. Sepono Nopekana, who is one of the senior members of the National Society of Black Engineers. In terms of our presentation, I'm going to start by just giving a bit of a background of who we are as the National Society of Black Engineers. And then I'll hand over to my colleague, Ms. Gekana, just to then take us through the meat of the presentation. And then after, we'll make conclusions and recommendations. In terms of NSBE, the National Society of Black Engineers was in existence from the early 90s. At the University of KwaZulu-Natal. So we are the ones that planted the seed for the FISMAS fault. The only difference is back then we were very timid and not as brave as the young lions that led to the promulgation of free education. In 1998, we formally launched and we called ourselves the National Society of Black Engineers. This is after the founding members came back from the US. They studied at the US, and in the US, you also have the National Society of Black Engineers, which is run by students. So we work very closely with them in our endeavors to push the agenda of black engineers. Between 1999 and 2003, there were a lot of monthly company visits so that the students can get an idea what it's like to work as an engineer in a corporate world. And then in 2006, we relaunched NSBE just to get the right energy levels to make sure that we push the agenda of black engineers in the country. And then between 2007 and 2010, we embarked on an investment initiative with Hulamin Shares as well as Sasol Shares. And then between 2009 and 2012, we pushed aggressively for transformation in the Engineering Council of South Africa. And we started this initiative because a lot of our engineers were complaining that they were battling to get professionally registered by EXA, and we're getting discriminated against. So we pushed very hard to transform EXA. And if you see on the next slide, you will see that our founding president, Mr. Cyril Kamete, is currently the president of the Engineering Council of South Africa. And our second president, Mr. Mlamoli Buthelezi, is the group COO at Transnet. And then he was replaced by Mr. Sipho Madonsela, who is currently the CEO of the Engineering Council of South Africa. And then after that, Mr. Tsiza Mthethwa took over, and then he is the GM at Transnet. And then last year we had an elective conference in Johannesburg where I officially took over from Mr. Mthethwa to lead the organization. In terms of our aims and objectives, the main purpose of our existence is to cultivate a positive culture and image of black engineers in our country. and we are quite active at the national level, and we also have regional presence in KZN, Johannesburg, and Mpumalanga. And we play quite an active role in the strategic positioning of engineers in the corporate world, and we make sure that we consult with the players in the private sector as well as the public sector to make sure that we create a platform and an environment that is conducive for full participation of black consulting engineers in the economic mainstream. We also go to schools to talk to the youth to make sure that they are aware about the engineering profession, and we motivate them to take up the profession because there's still a need for black engineers to participate in the profession. I think a lot of people in the room will know that at this time of the year we experience quite a lot of incidences at tertiary institutions. I was reading an article this morning, and unfortunately we've seen that in tertiary institutions, because of all the pressures of the exams coming in, we see students committing suicide because the pressures that they face to pass their exams. Because obviously, you know, some of them are coming from very poor backgrounds and their families are looking up to them to finish their studies and help out at home. So we play a role in going to tertiary institutions to mentor these students, to encourage them to pass through the exams, and also to just make them aware that, you know, if it doesn't work out at the university, there's always life after that. We've got people that studied engineering, people like in the entertainment industry, like Fetcho, that we all know. He was my classmate at UCT. He dropped out, but he made his life happen after that. So if you don't make it at the university, there's always a plan B. It doesn't mean that they must take their lives. So we also work with engineers in the corporate world to try and address their barriers for progress and for registration. And we focus a lot on women, black women in engineering. And that's why when the CEO, or the ex-CEO rather, of the South African Institute of Civil Engineers made disparaging remarks about women in engineering, we condemned that quite aggressively, and we lobbied the institution to ask him to step down, which eventually they did, and we welcomed that decision. We work with international links, like I said, with NSB in America. We work closely with them. In fact, they were in South Africa 2 years ago. We hosted them here. We went to UCT, and we engaged and had a meeting in terms of how we can collaborate together. So, you know, in a nutshell, we conduct our affairs in a very professional manner. We don't discriminate. Anyone is welcome to be a member as long as you subscribe to our aims and objectives, then you can be our member. We go to schools, as I said, to encourage kids, because at school, that's where you actually plant the seed and make people aware that, you know, they are capable of studying and to succeed in the profession of engineering. So as I'm speaking to you today, I got to the profession because when I was in grade 10, someone who was a practicing engineer, professional engineer, came to our school in Fosloras and addressed us, and that's how I got inspired to study the profession, because I saw someone who looked like me that was a successful engineer. We also get involved in key stakeholder engagements. We hosted our Honorable President, Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa, who was then the Deputy President. We had a breakfast, we hosted him, and he came to address us as engineers in terms of what his thoughts were about the role that we could play as engineers in the country. And subsequent to this breakfast, we actually submitted a paper to his office in terms of what we believe needed to be done to stimulate the economy and make sure that we industrialize our economy. For example, steel. We export quite a lot of raw material out of the country. And then that raw material gets made into steel, and then we end up buying rails and steel at a premium. So we're saying, let's not do that. Let's make sure that the raw material that we have in the country, we then use it to make steel ourselves, and that steel can then be used by our railways. That's one example. In terms of our membership, a majority of our members are in the construction space, energy space, as well as engineering consulting space. The total membership is 1,284. And this just gives a breakdown of our members who are registered as professional engineers. As you can see, the majority are still not registered, so we are working with them to guide them through the process. But we do have professional engineers and professional technologies in our ranks. In terms of the institutions where our students, where our members have studied, you will see that the majority of them came from University of KZN, UCT, Wits University, University of Johannesburg, Tshwane University of Technology, and others. And in terms of our in terms of where our members are currently employed or operating, you will see that the majority of our members are in state-owned enterprises as well as private sector. And then we also have representation from the national and provincial government. And then this graph just shows, in terms of the population of our membership, the majority practice as engineers and middle managers. We also have executive managers, chairman, CEO, and presidents in our ranks. So at this point, I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Ms. Kekana, to then just take us through the meat of our presentation.
I would like to thank our president for introducing our organization. Quite good. My name is Sipona Onokekan, and I will basically be focusing on the analysis of the RP from our perspective. Just to state up front, I'm a professional engineer, and I've spent my career working in the energy industry. I've worked in the coal power stations for more than 6 years, I think about 7 years. I've also worked in nuclear power stations, so you know. So basically, if you're looking at the RP that was released, it's very broad. There are too many subjects in one. We chose to focus on things that affect our members. Our members being the engineers, the engineers that we just given you the infographics for. So we focused on four areas. So we looked at the context in which this RP was formulated. We looked at the risk. We looked at unemployment effects. We looked also at the costing that was employed. So the first one that we looked at is a loss of context. We realized that in the way that they try to solve the problems, they use systems engineering sort of principles. So they have this model where the model has inputs into the model and the model has outputs. So we wanted to basically focus a little bit on the model, but focusing on context. As engineers, our role is to solve problems in the society. This is what we are taught to do. This is basically the gist of what our career is about. It's about solving problems in the society. But in us solving problems in the society, we have to solve them within context. Because if we don't solve problems within context, we're going to have what we call unintended consequences. That is why for us context is very important. We have to understand the context of in which you're solving a problem, because if you don't understand the context, then you are not solving the problem. So I want to put that clearly first. I also want to mention the fact that in the RP, they mentioned that this model that they've used is very sensitive. It's a very sensitive model. This is mentioned in the risk assessment, so we have to also put that at the back of our minds. So in terms of the inputs, these are inputs that are given into the model. The model, transforms the input into output. So whatever you put into the model is very, very important. The transformer, the model itself, is also very important, because if you put garbage into your model, you will get garbage out of the model. So that's why the input, that whatever you put into the model, is very, very important. So for example, in the input, they mentioned the fact that they looked at the different scenarios of electricity demands, projections, technology cost, fuel cost, fleet performance, additional commission capacity, emission cost, transmission cost. So when we looked at that, and the fact that they say that the model is very sensitive, there are things that could basically actually change the output of the model quite significantly there. For example, the transmission cost, they do take into account some transmission cost, but they don't take transmission cost in totality. If you look at the electricity demand that they've put, it's lagging. By that I mean, we believe that electricity demand should actually be leading. We should be looking at how we're going to use electricity infrastructure and planning as a way of us as a country achieving our growth, as opposed to it lagging. So this is basically what we believe. The technology cost, if you look at the technology cost that was used in the RP, they use what they called overnight cost. I haven't in my professional career come across engineering projects or projects that are compared on technology costs. I will give an example in another slide in terms of the kind of cost considerations that you have to do. The fact that, for example, economic parameters, they've used 13.57 to the dollar. And as we speak now, I think the exchange is probably 14 point something. I don't know what it is this morning, but it can change. So we need that, you can't actually use that. You have to look at the worst case scenario. So you have to analyze the curves and see what is the worst case scenario. Because also, if you change that particular input, your output could be significantly changed, given the fact that the model itself is very sensitive. Now, looking at the model that they've used is the Plexus model. The Plexus model, to us, as a general public, is a black box, because there's lack of transparency. We don't know the mechanics inside the model that are used to transform these inputs into outputs. So it's a black box, from that perspective, because it's not something that's very accessible. But be as that may be, if we assume that the output is correct, that the input is correct, that the output is correct, you also believe that you can't just take the output of a generic model that can be used in different countries and take that as it is. We believe that the output must be sanitized to bring context into your problem solving. You have to basically make sure that you don't lose context. And losing context, so we say that the output of that model must be taken into another process, which is the process of sanitizing the output. But basically looking at the particular issues in South Africa, or the particular context in which we're solving this problem. For example, one of the problems is that we have free education in this country that was approved, I think, was it last year? Yeah. It was approved last year. What does it mean? It means that there are more students that will have access to the education system. So in terms of your pipelining and where these people are going to work, you have to take that into account. We have seen earlier this year that there was stampede at one of the FET colleges, where the students were going in to go and get technical skills. These people are going there to be welders, they're going there to be boiler makers. When they finish, where are we going to place them? Shouldn't we be using energy as a way of trying to see, okay, how these people are going to be positioned, to basically get jobs? There are rising electricity prices in the country. There are skills being developed. If you look at different universities, for example, Best University has introduced a program, with nuclear, energy. Where are those people, those skills going to go to? There are skills where we're sending people to different countries. I was trained in France in nuclear technology, in line with the policies of the country. And that many of people like me, where are they supposed to go now if we're taking nuclear out of the picture completely? Where are these people supposed to go? There's poverty in the country that we have to look at. I mean, the black middle class in this country is taking care of not only themselves, they're taking care of other families, behind that they've left behind. So if we are not creating jobs and growing the middle class, then the poverty is not going to, we're not going to basically make a dent on that. So basically, the basic principle is that whatever problem you're solving, you must always solve it within context. You can't just take an output of a mathematical model as a solution without taking context into consideration, because these mathematical models are limited. And because you can use them in different countries, they don't take this, you know, country-specific, you know, context into account. So this is basically what we're saying, that the output of whatever model this is, first of all, we want transparency with the model. We want to see how this model takes the input into output. That's the first thing. The second thing we're saying, that it's not enough to take the output of a model. We have to sanitize the model by putting context in. The other thing that I want to say here is basically the costing considerations that they use. I mean, they use overnight costs in the RP. But in our experience as engineers, there's different things that you have to take into account in terms of costing. So there are different costing considerations that you have to take into account. For example, you have to, whatever technology you are looking at, you have to look at quality. What quality are you looking at? You have to look at availability. Is it available all the time? If you're going to compare technologies, you have to look at availability. Is it available all the time? Like, can I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and say I want 1 megawatt and I can get it, without asking whether there's the sun or there's wind or whatever? You know, so those are the things you have to look at. You have to look at operability. How easy is it? What operating costs are you looking at? Operability of whatever technology you're looking at. You have to look at reliability. How reliable is the technology that you're looking at? Because there's a cost associated with reliability. You have to look at maintainability. You have to look at the technical performance. What accuracy are you looking at? What sensitivity are you looking at? You have to look at other, you know, factors like localization, SED. You have to look at life cycle cost, decommissioning cost. How many times are you going to decommission, this technology within, you know, a period of 20 years or 60-year period? So we just say, in terms of how the cost was looked at and estimated in the RFP, it is not sufficient, because also the cost comparison is like they're taking costs from different sources. So some of the costs they're taking it from the RFP, you know, from EPRI, you know, some of it is taken from suppliers. So there's no consistency in terms of how they, you know, they take, you know, costs. And also they take costs from other projects. They say, okay, fine, this project, nuclear project, you know, costs this much. So in South Africa, it's going to cost this much. We're saying that costing for projects is not a linear process. It is not linear. So you can't just extrapolate whatever cost from one project to another. It is only when you have specifications for a particular project that you can cost it. You need specifications, you know, first. You can't cost a project with no specifications. You have to have specifications first to basically be able to, you know, to cost it. The other thing that we wanted to bring to your attention is unemployment. I think a lot of people know about this in the country. We hear about it, you know, all the time, but we just wanted to bring it in and basically talk about its relevance. Why are we putting these stats here, you know, for you to see? So you can actually see that we have 26.7% unemployment in this country. It's crisis. It's a very serious problem. It's a very we are one of the countries with the highest unemployment, and this is not normal. We need to be, you know, doing a lot more to try and get people employed. This is crisis. How is this relevant to the RP? I wanted to bring this picture up. You must never trust people who talk about unemployment and not tell you how and where these jobs are going to be formed. You know, people are going to be, you know, throwing around statistics, you know, we're going to create 61,000 jobs, whatever, 50,000 jobs. You must actually ask them, how are these jobs going to be created and where exactly are they going to be created? In engineering terms, this is what we call total cost of ownership of an asset. So if you have an asset, these are well accepted. So, you know, 6% of the amount is going to go to design. 20% will go to construction. 4% will go to disposal of the assets. And 70%, which is an overwhelming majority, goes to O&M, which is basically the maintenance of whatever asset that you have over the years. So in terms of job creation, you have to be able to show us exactly how the jobs are going to be created during the design process. How are they going to be created in construction? How are they going to be created in disposal? And how are they going to be created in operation? We have to be able to see that. But, you know, most of the jobs are created not in construction or design. They're actually created in operation, which is why it's so important to have, you know, infrastructure that, you know, goes for a long time. So, for example, I mean, I'm just looking at this in a solar plant or in a wind plant like that, as opposed to working in an industrial plant. You can see that it's very quiet. There's very, in terms of O&M, you know, operations and maintenance, there's very little maintenance and operations that are done there. If you go to an industrial plant there, I worked in a power station myself. You go there, you'll find engineers, electrical engineers, mechanical engineers. It's mostly technical skills. You'll find boiler makers, you'll find welders. It's busy. There's a lot of people there working. And they're working for 50 years, 60 years, because that's how long, you know, these plants are lasting. Now, if you go to I don't know if you guys have been to a solar plant, but you must take a visit and go there. It's very quiet. There's very little, you know, that's being done in a solar plant. So I don't know, in terms of O&M, which is the 70% of the total cost of ownership, where these jobs are going to come from. That's basically what I'm asking. And what quality of jobs are we creating? We are sending people to go to Tibet colleges. We are sending us to go study engineering. What quality of jobs are we going to have there? I personally would not want to finish my degree and go work and practice as an engineer in a solar farm, because there is not a lot to learn in terms of complexity of engineering principles that we need to learn in that particular environment. And I also wanted to say that we are the face, we black engineers or black professionals, we are the face of unemployment in this country. And that is the primary reason we are here. And we are here because we want to be here. We are the face of unemployment, black people. If you go to the streets, I mean, some of our members are employed. In fact, we didn't put the slide up with unemployment, but some of our members are actually unemployed. You can see that some of our members are actually going to the street and are saying, we have done, you know, engineering. There are engineering graduates in this country that are not employed. People think that we've got engineers who are employed, but we've got engineering graduates that are not employed in this country. We are the face of unemployment. And I wanted to actually show you a picture, economic impact of these power stations that they are earmarked for decommissioning. So this was a KPMG study, and you can actually see the number of jobs that these power stations are creating. And these jobs are actually high-quality jobs. These people are the lowest will be maybe artisans. These are very high-quality jobs that are being created in this industry. And this is not even talking about indirect jobs. You know, it's not even talking about the mining jobs. You'd realize that for every power station in Mpumalanga, there's a mine next to a power station. The mine is feeding the power station. So this is just considering the jobs only for the power stations, but there are mines there's a mining industry that's linked to these power stations, you know, for example. And you know, that's employing, you know, people. There are small businesses that are taking coal from, you know, some of the mines, open cast mines, to these power stations. There's a lot of jobs that are going to be lost. In fact, it's something that we have to think about. And unfortunately, it is our members, because a lot of our members are actually working in those areas. Including myself, I work there. I still have a home there that are going to be affected by this. So we have to look at this very seriously. We can't be in a mode where we're going to be destroying jobs. We have to create more jobs. We can't be destroying more jobs. So we have to be very innovative in terms of the way that we think of solutions. We have to be very innovative. You know, we can't be destroying jobs. We have to create jobs. We can't destroy those jobs. Those jobs, because, you know, they are high quality, you know, jobs. Okay, the other thing that we looked at is the risk analysis. So the risk analysis in the RP, we think that it's not sufficient. So, for example, in the RP, it says that, you know, we're going to decommission 12 gigawatt of energy, but we don't know what the socio-economic impact is. This is like putting the horse, you know, in front of the cart, or the cart in front of the horse, or the other way around. How do you make a decision to do something and you don't know what the impact is? And this impact is on people's lives. This is on the impact on people's livelihoods. This is basically what the RP says. It says, we're going to decommission this 12 gigawatt of energy, but we don't know what the impact is on these people. And also, you know, in terms of a consideration for the risk in terms of, you know, the gas, they say, okay, fine, we're going to use wind and solar, because there's very high penetration of wind and solar in the RP, supported by gas. And basically, you know, the ARP says in the risk assessment that, okay, fine, we don't know what the impact is of the gas, you know, the changes in gas prices. We haven't done that analysis. But we made this decision that, okay, we must have wind and solar supported by gas. But we don't know what the impact is. You can't do that. You can't say things like that and say that, okay, you don't know what the impact is. That study needs to be done. We need to know exactly what the impact is going to be. We need to take the worst case scenario and see what is the worst case scenario, what does it mean for, you know, for the country. Also, the other one is, you know, in the risk assessment is about Inga. You know, the fact that there is power from Inga, hydropower from Inga, where it talks about the fact that we're going to have get power from, you know, from Inga, and the risk assessment that they've identified is around building. You know, it's around building, and they talk about the fact that it was a desktop study. But there are other risks that are associated with that. You're going to be taking power that's going through different countries who don't have power themselves, these countries. So these countries are going to be seeing this power going to South Africa from Congo, and they don't have it. You know, so those kind of things, you know, do you think that they're going to just, you know, say, okay, it's going to South Africa? We do, you know, take power to other countries now. It's not a problem because we're bringing them power, but now we're going to be taking power from another country that's passing through many other countries. So we can't expect that everybody's just going to be happy and say it's going to South Africa. There's also very well-documented political issues with regards to Inga that are not even identified as a risk in the ARP. It is not sufficient. So the risk analysis in the ARP needs to be looked at, you know, very, you know, because there's a lot of things that, you know, we don't know what the impact, you know, of this. So the risk assessment within the ARP really needs to be looked at in detail. I just wanted to say that, yes, our members, actually, a lot of them, you know, live in Mpumalanga, including myself. I still have a home there in Mpumalanga. And if you're looking at the members and at the membership, you know, that we've shown you, we have a lot of members in the energy and the mining, in the mining sector, and that's exactly where these members are. They're working in the mines there and working in the power stations there, and we're going to be severely affected by this RP. We have to see how we're going to preserve these jobs. So this is what we see as a direct impact on our members. So first of all, is the socio-economic impact. So we've shown you with the study how those mines and those power stations contribute to the local to the local economy. But also we have to realize that these people that are working there are like in the black middle class, and the black middle class in South Africa is taking care of not only themselves, but taking care of their parents back home in the rural areas. If you're affecting that middle class, you're not only affecting them, you're going to be affecting those areas or those people that they're taking care of back home, because most of them are doing this. This is something, it's well known, it's called black tax that people pay. So we're going to be affecting them. So the socio-economic impact needs to be looked at really, really closely. It could be very devastating. So the second one is the difficulty to register. You have seen our president showed us that a large space of our members are not registered with EXA, and we want them to register. How are they going to register if they're working in a solar plant or in a wind plant? There's a certain level of complexity from an engineering perspective that is required for an engineer to register as a professional engineer. I can tell you, our engineers will not register working in those. So you have to strike a balance. Because also as engineers, we have to be competitive with the rest of the world. And that comes with working in the complex, you know, complex engineering systems like in a nuclear power station, or you know, in a power station like a coal power, in a thermal power station. If you have your engineers in terms of development, they are coming from varsity and they're going to be working in a solar plant and going to work. It's a very simplistic plant. I'm sure everybody can see it. I mean, if you go there, you can actually see it yourself. There's no complexity. There's a certain level of complexity that you require your engineers to be exposed to for them to be developmental and to basically, you know, innovate and industrialize. And if we are going that way, then we see difficulty in terms of our engineers being able to register. We also see this as undermining the Black Industrialist, you know, program. There's a Black Industrialist program where we are keen, we are very excited as, you know, as engineers, we want to industrialize this country, but we have to industrialize in the industry. If we are not going to be having, you know, industries like that where project life cycle is longer, it gives us time to localize. and industrialize, not a project that is going to take a year or 2 years, because in that period you don't have enough time to localize and innovate, you know, and do all of that. So we want projects that, you know, take longer, 10 years, so that we can actually localize, you know, those kind of projects. We can industrialize. So we're looking, you know, we see this as basically maybe a step back in terms of policy. I mean, you've got one policy that wants to develop black industrialists on this side, but you've got the energy policy on this side that's not really, you know, supporting it. Also, we see this as loss of skills. I don't know if you know this, but there's a lot of our skills. We've got a lot of skills in the country in terms of our nuclear engineers and scientists in our electrical engineers. They're working in other countries. We are losing skills to other countries. There's about 80 engineers we hear that are working in the Middle East, you know, in nuclear projects in the Middle East. They are in Hinckley projects. They're in America. They're all over the world. The engineers are going all over the world because they can't find, you know, the kind of work, you know, even though they've acquired skills in South Africa. So in conclusion, we think that the RP must be amended. It is not sufficient. There's too many things in it that are not thought through that needs, you know, further thinking. We think it needs to be amended. We actually have determined that it's going to negatively impact on our members and their families and the people that they take care of. We think that it's going to lead to job losses. We have to find a way of preserving jobs, especially those high quality jobs, because as a country we're grappling with, you know, STEM, you know, getting, you know, people into STEM sort of careers, engineers. So we can't tell people we don't have enough engineers in the country and then go, you know, put them in university to study engineering. When they come back, they don't have jobs because of the way that we're trying to do things. So we need to find a way to preserve those high quality jobs. And we need to find a way of absorbing this new breed of, you know, students who are becoming welders and who are becoming boiler makers. We think that this RFP is going to compromise security of supply. I don't know about the other engineers. We've got a lot of engineers here. But as an engineer, I want baseload to be secure. I do not want baseload to not be secure. Baseload is the minimum power that you need, that I can wake up at night and say, 1 o'clock in the morning, I need 1 megawatt, I get it. And it's not dependent on whether there's a sun or there's wind. I can't take that kind of risk on the economy. I want to know that the economy is secured. So, you know, so in terms of the security of supply, we think high penetration of renewables in the grid compromises energy security. We also are looking at, we think that R228 will reverse empowerment gains. There's a lot of, you know, empowerment, as you've seen, I mean, a lot of our members actually working in SOEs. They're working in SOEs. A lot of small businesses, like, you know, are being incubated in these SOEs. So if we're privatizing, you know, Eskom, we see that as a reverse in terms of empowerment gains, because we don't know this IPP program in terms of, you know, the credentials so far with regard to empowerment. They're not very impressive. And if you have to put that, you know, with Eskom in terms of, you know, the enterprise development they've done through Meduca and Kusile, you can't even compare the two. So there will be a reversal of some gains in terms of empowerment that we're trying to strive to. We also think that this RP compromises sovereignty of the country, because a lot of dependence is put on, first, the dependence is put on intermittent sources of energy, which is wind and solar. But secondly, it's put on things that we don't have in the country, like gas, that we don't have in the country. I am yet to see a country that is overlooking its own competitive edge and basically going for things that, you know, are not really the competitive edge. Can you imagine in the Middle East if they say, we're not going to use the oil that we have. We're going to go get coal from South Africa, and we're going to use it for our energy sources. There's a specific reason why we are here, you know, in South Africa, and we have coal. We have to use it. The onus is on us to innovate in terms of, you know, the innovation is there in terms of, you know, our new coal, in terms of cleaner coal, you know, so that's what we have to do. But we can't put this, you know, the security, the energy security of the country on outside, you know, on outside influences. But now we are struggling to control the fuel price that's going out of control. It's increasing every day. We're saying it's the dollar. A lot of our people in this country don't even understand what that means. all they want is gas, but we can't now do the same thing with electricity. We're going to have to explain to them, the people, and say, okay, fine, their gas prices have gone up. You know, the dollar has gone up, and they don't even understand that. We need to make sure that we use the resources that we have as a country. It is our competitive edge. The thing is that we need to be innovative in terms of how we use what we have. So this is what we recommend as the National Society of Black Engineers. Our engineers have deliberated, and this is what we said is ideal. This is what is ideal IP from my perspective. 75% base load made up of coal and nuclear energy. So this is basically based on the premise that we can't take that kind of risk in terms of base load. Base load energy, it has to be there, it has to be dispatchable at any time, it has to be available, it has to be reliable. And then we are not against solar or wind. I have to put that, we are not against solar or wind. We think that it's good to have a healthy energy mix that prioritizes, you know, the country. And we think 25% wind and solar supported by either gas or battery storage is basically good, you know, for the mix. So we are advocating for a mix. We're not against any, just like a transport system with different types of transport. We've got, you know, we've got air transport, we've got Ubers, we've got taxis. We think that a robust energy mix, you know, must be made of different technologies. But those technologies must complement each other in such a manner that security, South African, you know, energy security is put first. We also want a mix that will basically put Eskom in the control. We are against privatization of Eskom. We think there's a place for independent power producers to basically, you know, play a role, but the role must be limited to about 30% or less. We think that Eskom is not just an electricity provider, it has a developmental responsibility or role that it's playing. I was sponsored by Eskom from varsity. I was sponsored by Eskom, I worked at Eskom, you know, for the good part of my life, and so I had a lot of engineers that I studied with, that they actually were sponsored by Eskom. There are a lot of engineers. There's a lot of engineers that Eskom has, you know, has produced. There's a lot of SMEs that has produced. People that I worked with in the department where I was working, now they're running small businesses, their own business, consulting engineering businesses. They did that at the back of, you know, Eskom. So Eskom has not only a electricity provision, you know, role that is playing, but there's a developmental role and a transformation role that is played. And if you ignore that, then you're going to ignore that at your own peril. So that's why we believe that Eskom must retain control. But you know, there is a space for IPPs to play. We're not against IPPs at all. We also think that an ideal RP will advocate for preservation of jobs, not destruction of jobs. So the jobs that we have, the high quality jobs that we have, we must preserve them. We must find a way of preserving them. We must be innovative and we must save this job. And also, I believe that IRP would also look at the VB element because we're not hearing this, So we still have a role, a responsibility to transform the country in terms of localization. We don't know what sort of localization and SME support these the current IPPs are basically, you know, contributing to the country. That's why we're calling for an audit, because we want to know what BE. What sort of transformational, you know, credentials are, you know, the recent IPPs that have been signed contributing to the country? Because we think this is still important for the country to do. So if you want to ask us any questions and you want to know more about us, those are our details. I have to mention, as a parting short, that we are subscribed to the BBC, so we are affiliated members of, you know, the BBC. We also agree with what the BBC has taken out as a recommendation. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Okay. question on the recommendation. What is it said? We decided to build the stage. Thank you, Chair. Honorable Chair and members and colleagues and other stakeholders, it's a pleasure for me to be here. As indicated, I'm Ronald Chauke. I'm the head of energy portfolio within the organization and doing tax abuse, in short, OUTA. I'm the guy focusing on the energy side, and then I'm a civil activist as such. So I will be brief, because Honorable Chair, you indicated most of our recommendations and the way we approach it, you'll find that are more or less similar. So in order to save time, I shouldn't re-emphasize what has already actually been put on the table. The content is as outlined. I'll briefly touch on who's outer, our context, the legislative landscape, the key assumptions and the recommendations we made from our analysis of the IRP. We are a proudly South African non-profit civil organization which focuses more on holding the executive accountable to ensure that our taxes are used to prosper us as South Africans. Our values are accountability, transparency, and making sure that the public interest is taken into account. We prefer to go for constructive engagement rather than the destructive one, because we want to build a prosperous nation. And then we basically focus more on the building the strategic partnerships and then ensuring that there is zero tolerance to corruption, wasteful spending, and then we make sure that most of the people we work with help us to provide the solution to the country's challenges by becoming active citizens. From our analysis, we would like to commend the Department of Energy's endeavors in promoting our transition to a low-cost energy mix, whereby we promote the issues related to us meeting our international obligations in terms of climate change and then fostering a more sustainable energy sector as we move forward. We understand that there are dynamics in that space, however, we support actually the move for us to help South Africa actually to use cleaner sources of energy, regardless of us being well endowed with other resources. Hence, a balanced approach is critical. The integrated resource plan, as it stands, it is a long-term program which outlines the generation mix. And then from a civil society point of view, we are more actually interested in the policy rationality component. Some of our colleagues might ask us, why do we say policy rationality? It's very, very important that when we do our policy choices, we balance it. It shouldn't be one-sided, so that we protect the interests of the country. Hence, we support the issue in line with the Energy White Paper of 1998 on the diversification of energy sources in our journey to meet our energy requirements, and then we ensure that as participants in the space, we have to assist government actually towards this journey of a low carbon economy, because it's very, very important that we make sure that we move towards that. The legislative landscape, as I indicated, is quite critical, and then it's very, very important that our energy infrastructure, as articulated in the development plan, is clearly, implementable. For instance, when you look at the development plan, it says energy infrastructure is a critical component that underpins economic activity and growth across the country. It needs to be robust, extensive, enough to meet, the needs from all spectrums of our value chain.
So from where we sit, we agreed as a team of professionals within civil society to say that let's look at what the department has put on the table and then let's critique it, not from a destructive point of view, but from a constructive point of view, to see what is practical and what is good for the country, and then what is not good, and then what contribution can we make to that effect. So in terms of the assumptions, we found that the assumptions by themselves are very, very optimistic. And then we recommend, as part of the slide which I'll come to, whereby we said that the department has to be cautious in being optimistic, and then it should base actually the IRP on the realities which we have. As indicated in the SALGA presentation, you'll find that since 2007, our levels of electricity demand growth is very, very low, meaning that we need to find ways and means in which we can be able to say that how do we propel the economy to grow at a faster rate. However, from where we are now, using the current situation as a baseline, should we be over-optimistic or be more realistic? So those are the lessons which we prefer that we need to engage upon and then find a common ground. For instance, you'll find that some of the assumptions, as indicated, they include the issues of ESCOM plant performance, of which is variable, to the extent that where we are now in terms of plant availability compared to the IRP 2010, where it was at 80%, we are at 71% at the present moment. And then when you look at the technology cost, we had serious challenges on those ones, as indicated by our Association of Black Engineers, whereby when you look at the technology cost as outlined in the EPRI study, they are very, very much robust, it's fine. However, from a South African context and this IRP, when it comes to pump storage, the actual cost which we used were the Ingula pump storage cost, which actually plummeted from 9.8 billion to 28 billion. The question is, should you use those kind of costs? Are they realistic? Or you are just setting yourself actually to what you can call an overpriced build program? So those are some of the issues which we flagged, and then we would like the DOE actually to come to its senses and then be much more pragmatic when it comes to that. And then our recommendations, as I indicated, it's very, very important that we adopt a balanced approach so that our choices, they help us to achieve what we call reasonable and then acceptable, actually, developmental goals which the country aspires to achieve. And then we prefer that the IRP, as compared to the previous experience, it shouldn't actually become an outdated document, whereby you find that we end up saying that it has to be reviewed every 2 years, but you find that nothing happens within that 2 years, and then the assumptions become irrelevant, and then most of the people start to question even how do we contemplate to move forward. And then the other thing, we looked into the situation on the nuclear role, because we emphasized that the IRP clearly outlines that the economic life of Uber, of which is the only power station, will come to actually to an end not later than 2047. So we are saying that if ever South Africa wants nuclear to be part of a future mix post 2030, the Department of Energy has to clarify the policy position on nuclear, because it shouldn't come as a surprise, but it should be something which the department actually started to say that in various scenarios which have been modeled, there is a nuclear scenario, and then this is how it looks like. This is the impact it's going to have on our build program cost, on the pricing, and then in the whole mix, so that we are all on the same page, rather than finding civil society again challenging the decision at a future stage to say that this nuclear is not affordable, it shouldn't be part of that, and all things like that. So we'd rather be transparent. And then the other thing is that when you look at the determination of 2014 by the minister, coal was actually allocated 2,500 megawatts, and when you look at the current IRP, we say it's 1,000 megawatts. The question is, we want clarity as to whether will the balance actually be factored into future ministerial redetermination, or that determination actually falls flat, meaning that it's going to be rescinded. If ever it is not rescinded, then the DOE should come in to say that whatever determinations which have been done before, all of them, even if they have not yet been executed or procured, those determinations are still effective. So it's very, very important that that is clarified so that we know what is the possible future role of coal in our future energy mix. And then we are requesting the department as well to consider coming up with minimum specific allocation for energy storage so that we take into account the need of how do we balance a power system which is likely to be much more dominant by intermittent power sources, rather than saying that we don't necessarily need a new power mix. For us, we say that get a power mix, however, make sure that that power mix on its own, there are all the necessary support initiatives that will help it to be effective so that we don't find ourselves in a power shortage environment at the future stage. And then the other thing was, which we deliberated, was the issue of balancing the replacement of new generation in order to make sure that what is planned as Eskom decommissioning what we call capacity, there shouldn't be actually a very, very big missing link there. Because if ever the timing in which the ministerial determination is not well managed and well balanced, that issue of your 3-year procurement gap, which happens with the round 4 renewable independent power producers program, is likely to repeat itself. And then if ever it repeats itself exactly that way, where Eskom actually refused to sign those power purchase agreement, it means that at that point in time we'll have a power shortage. So if you are having that power shortage, the question is how do we mitigate it? Given the challenges whereby when you look at our economic development, we are in the low, and then we are pursuing South Africa to get back to a high economic development trajectory. So from civil society side, we say that it's very, very important that we take the interests of the country and put them as our priority, and make sure that in terms of our planning, we take into account all the possible issues that are likely to compromise us. And then we also looked at the issue of the allocation of gas at 16%, given the fact that we are not actually ourselves a gas-endowed country. The question is, why that huge allocation? It means that we need to rethink that allocation. To the extent that we ended up saying that it's very, very important that the DOE, as it disclosed in the IRP, in its section of recommended studies, it says that the impact of gas has not yet been undertaken. That you cannot allocate a huge amount from something which we have been done at due diligence or conducted the full study, so that you know your mix makes much more rational. And then the other thing we said that there are an issue of other scenarios which have not yet been run. So it's very, very important that scenarios which were run through the modeling exercise, they have to be expanded in the final IRP to ensure that all areas are covered, whether we are at a high growth level, at a medium growth level, as well as at a low growth level. And then the impact thereof must be taken into account. And then as indicated also, the issue of our socio-economic implications has to be factored. If ever it is not comprehensively factored, at least the minimum study which takes into account the possible likelihood has to be undertaken, and then the promulgated IRP should put that into effect. When we come to embedded generation, most of our colleagues have already talked to it, including SALGA and our black engineers. So the issue is that the 200 allocated, honestly speaking, is nothing. That one can be done by one municipality, and not within 11 years, given the fact that this IRP is for 11 years. These 200 megawatts which has been allocated, it can be done in 1 year or in 6 months by a particular municipality. So the question is, can the DOE at least adjust that? So what we looked at, we said that there is a challenge in terms of the allocation which has been given to the Grand Inga of 2,500 megawatts. To us, that project has been in the making for more than 20 years. And then given the dynamics and the challenges of sourcing power from as far away as the DRC, it might not be an ideal move for us. We understand and respect the issues of various treaties that have been signed. However, we say that let's be pragmatic. Let's start by focusing on things which are within our control. And then if ever the DOE might want to make a special determination to that effect, they can consider it. I don't know whether it will be under unsolicited bids, whatever the case may be, at that particular point in time when Grand Inga issues have been resolved. However, we prefer and recommend that that allocation of 2,500 megawatts allocated to the Grand Inga be shifted from Grand Inga allocation, and then either it be used to complement the allocation for embedded generation. Because that one we can easily do it, it is within our control, and then we are capable of doing it in-house inside the country through the various resources and players who can be able to assist us to do so. And then we also said that the system operator must come up with the issue of clarifying the potential risks which are likely to be posed by our migration towards a more renewable energy-based energy supply. Because in that space, as our colleagues have indicated, there are issues of grid stability. And then if ever our grid is not configured into that extent that it can absorb high quantities of intermittent power, then it means that system operator has to tell us actually what will be the types of investment that are required to modernize the grid, and then what are the cost implications associated with that. If not, they can easily say that as part of the transmission, development plan, they have factored that into account. This is its cost, and those costs should be directly reflected and then highlighted in the IRP, so that we understand that we are not only looking at the generation side, but we are also looking at how that power will be evacuated, and then our demand-supply balancing is under control. And then the other thing we said that we need clarity from a policy point of view in terms of how the future new coal bill is likely to be dealt with. For instance, when you look at how Standard Bank has announced its position, Standard Bank came clean and said that from now on, henceforth, we will no longer be funding investment into the construction of new coal power plants. So for us as a country, we need to come clean. If ever coal, as indicated in the draft IRP, is going to be decommissioned, to be realistic, it means that by 2050, the power that would be on the grid from the coal side, from the baseload side, it would be power from Medupi, Kusile, as well as the 100 megawatts from the IPP. That is the only power that would be in the grid. Basically, let's say, for instance, 9,600, more or less than 10,000. And then that raises a serious issue about ESCOM, of which, Chair, I don't want to put it in here. It means that basically ESCOM, in terms of the generation side, is out of business. Now, let's be truthful, and not hide. And if ever that's the case, it means our colleagues, as they indicated, that how do we preserve ourselves, balance the economy, maintain the skills, build our capabilities? How is it going to happen? So it's very, very important that those that have to flag that before we can even say that this is the final IRP. And then all in all, there is another situation of which is a risk, which I believe DOE must request ESCOM to submit their abatement retrofit program, given the fact that there are power stations which have already been identified that they are not meeting their compliance requirements with the Department of Environmental Affairs. So ESCOM has to come clean to say that these are the plans in place, this is what they are investing in, ensuring that they are fixing and retrofitting those power plants so for them to comply. Because if that is not resolved, When we get to a worst case scenario, of which it should also be modeled, then the DEA say that Eskom power plants, because they failed to comply for that particular time period, those plants have to be taken offline, meaning that they will no longer be supplying. The question is, will our renewable energy power plant be ready to dispatch the power which we will have lost from the Eskom failure to meet its environmental obligations? Because here you are dealing with a demand-supply balancing. So that's why we emphasize that you are planning of how new power has to come into play, and then how old power will be replaced with new power. It's very, very critical to the extent that if you miss it, Honorable Chair, trust me, we are in load shedding. It can even be permanent load shedding if we don't do it right. So we emphasize that the DOE, those scenarios, has to take those scenarios into account and then make sure that they are factored into the equation. On that note, Chair, I believe that I've covered most of our key things, and then we are available in line with the contact details as displayed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Let Business Council.
Saturday, Friday. This is just 1 hour after this way.
Good day, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Parliamentarians, and the House at large. My name is Sepo Mashaba. I happen to become a consulting engineer as well, and an entrepreneur in the power space over the last 25 years. Here I'm being supported by, we represent two organizations, Black Business Council and South African Energy Forum. Around me, I'll just introduce my colleagues as well who come from both organizations. That's Mr. Sithole on the far left, who happens to be an engineer as well, and Mr. Maphalala, who happens to be an engineer as well, myself, Mr. Zamo, who happens to be an engineer as well, and Mr. Tumagute, who unfortunately is an engineer as well. We represent, as I said, BBC is represent the interest of a federation of black businesses and black associations in SA. We all know BBC has been very instrumental in the formation of government black industrialization program. Also here amongst us, we represent an organization called South African Energy Forum, which is SAEF, which is a group of black business and patriotic homegrown industrialists who coming from all walks of life. This includes scientists, it's black, white, Indian, but mostly led by black companies and individuals, and which is mostly scientists, we are nuclear, renewable, coal, gas, and business school academics, professors from universities, economists, energy equipment suppliers, civil society, labor unions, power generation experts, and mostly youth structures. We are not an organization that is technology specific. We don't promote and lobby for any technology, but we are here because we believe in a very balanced energy mix for South Africa that utilizes electricity as a measure to stimulate the economic growth of South Africa. In the recent past ELA this year, we tried to get, because we believe electricity is a literal human right, and it affects not only the educated, the engineers, and people that are of higher echelon, but literally it affects every man on the street. So we tried by all means to see in whatever we do to include and get the voice of people that are outside there who are yearning to understand how energy affects them in their daily lives. We tried to get, we are very proud to have a formulation of a very revolutionary and a vibrant energy forum that we formed earlier this year, where we invited a lot of energy experts, the public at large, ESCOM CEOs, NEXA leadership, NERSA leadership, the media, and the public at large, to make sure have a very balanced view of everyone else who wants to interact with them. This was a platform that literally became a 24-hour platform that interestingly ended up generating about 500 to 1,000 messages of communication with these experts, people trying to understand how energy affects them on their daily lives. They're saying thank you for providing us with a long-awaited draft IRP that we've been longing for and yearning for, and an opportunity to comment on this draft IRP. We believe there are concerns on the shortcomings of this draft IRP. Some we believe are mere oversight. Some we believe are mere intentional. We do not represent, as I said, any lobby group or that law for any technology, but a balanced energy plan that will actually leave our next generation not to be in poverty, while we have extracted every single commercial business in today as we are alive for the next generation not to find anything available. Before we even start looking at the draft IRP, I just want to show you, because my eyesight doesn't work that well. on the reference IRP that we believe was formed in 2010, the 2010/2030 IRP, which was literally based on as a leap that happened out of the load shedding that we saw in 2007, where our government in those years, let me try the thing again, in 2007 was one of those years economically that was very powerful in our era, where the economy was pumping, electricity was at its highest point till to date. So we modeled it, and it collapsed because of the reasons that we made politically to make sure that we do not include newer generation of power stations, and hence this 2010-2030 RP was based on. If you look at how it looked like, literally it was more a base load biased IRP, which literally recognized coal as the basis of our energy generation. Literally, again, before we even had a political mudslinging on nuclear. Nuclear, because we are one of the best countries in the world that produces nuclear, nuclear was a very strong component in 2010-2030 to one of the highest components, actually, at 11,400 megawatts. Only thing that we saw that became a bigger issue in the 2010 was having gas and diesel, which was at a very high, because we were responding on a peaking system that actually emanated from the load shedding situation, where we're using all the diesel, because we don't have gas, we use a lot of diesel, but I'm sure everyone else knows that since 2010 up until 2014, we're utilizing over 14 billion rand a year on just diesel alone. That literally crippled ESCOM. Hence, we believe gas and diesel was given a higher, not because it was really required but to make sure to make up for the load shedding that we saw in our country. And interestingly so, it was very aggressive, because it was almost close to 89.5 gigawatts of power, which really required a very drastic
input into our in, into our system. I'm going to start with just analyzing a little bit. Please forgive me on this because the energy subject is a very emotional one. Sometimes I'm not going to go. I'll look at that. At that was really analyzing what it looked like as it stands, the draft RFP 2018. One, the bigger issue that we have is that it's misaligned with the NDP that we have of our country, which literally which specifies the reduction of unemployment, enhancement of GDP growth to up to 5%, alleviation of poverty, and literally fails to show how can be used as a tool to achieve any of these items mentioned in the NDP. So in literal terms, we have a guiding document of our country called the NDP, but having a draft RP that literally says to us, the NDP, I'm not aligned with you. It is based on its basis as it was formed. Understandably so, is based out of reducing carbon emissions, but utilizing renewable sources at the expense of reliable baseload technology, which is nuclear and coal. As I said, we are not climate change deniers. Maybe you see engineers thinking that thing, they're just thinking industrialization at the expense of industrialization. We're not. But we acknowledge the fact that the top six countries in the world, which is China, US, UK, France, and Japan, and many of those, contribute over 70% of global emissions. And South Africa contributes just a mere 1%. Literally, we're just a drop in an ocean compared to what the world has done in as far as carbon emissions in the world. So for us to try and make an RP that literally focuses on what only we've done for 1% as a contribution, when all the other top six countries have not conformed to the Paris Agreement, they did in the beginning, many of them have pulled out. I'm sure you must have seen US recently, we've seen China recently, we've seen Australia recently, we've seen Germany, who said we will do renewables. But we're not at the level of trying to impress the world with the Paris Agreement that says it's either renewable or not. All of us must remember, God has given us coal. It is ours. It's one of those things to be proud of and not be seen. And somebody said, he said it's dirty. I think it's something else to look at it politically. If you look at even what would happen if we had to leave all the coal power stations to run up until 2050, literally would affect the temperature rise of the Earth by 0.058 degrees in temperature rise. If we were to remove all the coal-fired power stations that are new, that as the RP 2018 draft says, we literally increase the temperature rise of 0.006 degrees. But all of this happening at the cost of 1.6 trillion. So what it says is that the reason why the major top seven are running out of this, who are very wealthy, by the way, they are saying, if they can't afford it, I wonder if South Africa is in such a dire state as we speak, how can you afford this at the expense of our economy? There's a myth that has been going around for years that only solar and wind are clean. And I want to clarify this, probably my colleagues will assist me on this, on trying to unravel what this cleanliness means. If I look at a wind farm, wind blades, those huge wind blades that are 5 meters each, 12 meters each, sorry, 50 meters each of a wind blade, they, when you make those wind blades, you use iron ore, which is mined, it's called dirty. You use coal, you use coking coal to make them to become the hardness of this steel. So it means it's only the generation of the power in the wind that is clean, but the composition of, so it means it's value chain across the chain. There's no cleanliness as people are claiming it to be. We take solar panels. Solar panels are made out of concentrated silicon, which is mined there in Tabazimbi. We have it in South Africa, in Tabazimbi. Silica is a chemical compound that is not regarded as clean. So even the solar panel, if they're saying it's clean, how it traps the sun is a cleaner process. But across the value chain of it, it's not as clean because even the material of construction is not clean. So even on disposal of these, they're actually toxic. All these elements I'm talking about are toxic. So the value chain of what we've been told and sold that is clean is not as clean as we think. Interestingly, the uranium that we have in South Africa,
is probably the cleanest chemical compounds in a periodic table of chemistry. On top of this, what we can think of is environmental impact. That has been, as I've learned, the previous colleagues have talked about, people have died in Pelindaba, in Nekra, because they were radioactive. It's a very interesting part that we have, South Africa is a country that has an abundance of the widest range of bird species in the world. In Germany alone, wind turbines are killing 330,000 of bird species every year. I wonder if somebody would tell environmental impact can count on the other part and forget it when it's a part of it. So I was trying to try, before we start talking about the RP, and clarify the misiness of saying somebody is clean. They are not as clean as we think they are. All technologies have got their own, pros, and it's got their own cons. It's very interesting, though, that if we are trying to reduce the carbon emissions, and yet the RP, that the draft RP that we have, removes the cleanest technology called nuclear almost to zero. How are we intending, as a government, to basically know that we've done so without utilizing what we have naturally coming for us as a country? That I want to understand that part. Nuclear, let me say it again, is the lowest cost, cleanest technology that has got the highest capacity factor above 90%. When most of the renewables, our capacity factor means the availability in a 24-hour day. Other sources, not to say we're talking them, but I want to put it in perspective. Then let's not try and make the issue of cleaner, other ones are dirty. If the availability of renewables are probably sitting between 25% availability per day. For sure we know in South Africa that wind blows between 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the morning at the most efficient rate. The sun bends between 10 o'clock, effect from 10 o'clock till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Other than that, all the other ones base load. So basically what we're saying is our presentation literally shows the importance of base load in the IRP, which has been negated in the draft that we've just seen in 2013. South Africa, very interestingly, is a world leader in base load technologies. Over at least 100 years. People don't know this. South Africa was the first member of the International Atomic Energy Corporation in the world. The first member to join. To show the prowess of what... It is shown by the fact that when we make nuclear isotopes, medical isotopes, we are the top leader in the world in making them. So even our nuclear development over years is something that we cannot just throw away just because somebody came in with a newer technology. And coal. Probably we are the only country in the world that has used the lowest grade of coal in calorific value to burn coal to power generation. Many of the countries in the world, they use higher CVs, but the technology that Eskom developed since 1922 was less developed, the cheapest. Hence, that is why South Africa, being the furthest country in the world to Europe, still Europe wants to see us. Not because we've got more gold. Libya has got more gold, many countries have got oil, but it's because of all the resources we've managed to make sure that you get the cheapest power to drag out the resources out of our land. Interestingly, as I said, the draft IRP favors the clean intermittent sources, which, in my knowledge, are unable to drive intensive industries like smelters. You can't run a smelter that needs to heat aluminium when the sun is gone, because it has to have a coefficient of heating over time. If you say I'm running by the solar, it means at 4 o'clock you must shut off the factory and say I'm going to see you smelting tomorrow. There are smelters, there are mines. You can't say at night I can't work on night shift in a mine to take the huge winder that takes even a train from underground onto the surface and say I'm running it out of a solar plant and doing it only during the day. These mines, mineral beneficiaries, which are the main drivers of South African employment, GDP, economic growth and exports. Hence the balance of payment of a country is dependent on the beneficiation and the mining of coal in South Africa. Interestingly again, as I said, the draft IRP favors solar and wind technologies which create jobs in source countries where this technology is made from. Interestingly, I don't know how we've made this. I have to say this again. South Africa developed a Roy Falk, the best helicopter, artillery helicopter in the world. We can't tell me we cannot manufacture a solar panel. after making a Rafael helicopter, which is number one artillery military of the world. There's no way you cannot make our own Shepherds, but we've been forced right now to accept this technology, to say wind and solar, they actually, when we know very well are made in Germany, are made in Spain, and none of them, we're only installers. So it means all they can provide is the jobs that are construction jobs take, because they're even proud to say it takes a cycle of 2 years. Ours are very quick to go up to, it means we're going to provide jobs for 2 years. After that, in solar plants, only a cleaner is available. So it means you want to cut out the jobs of, as NSD colleague had said, cut out the architects, the geologists, the metallurgists underground working in the mine with somebody to say who has never been, who just comes in as a solar panel cleaner. Hence, we challenge even the Minister of DOE, who has claimed, telling the President, that they're going to be bringing us 64,000 jobs. And I want to know, what is the quality of this job? Which university teaches somebody to go and clean a solar panel? So it means we are negating what we've done so many years in the past of such expensive human resource by someone's going to come in there and say this is, and hence that's why they changed to say job years, because they could not account. When I've been asked consistently for the last 6 years, what is the quality of a job that you find in a solar plant and a wind plant once it's operational? The very interesting, a very touching one we've learned because of history. We have had many of the Spaniard companies that are in the Northern Cape, solar companies, where they import up until the grass cutter from Spain. And if somebody is there, will get the proof for you that literally they are there even to empower not even their technical, specific technical people, but even just a person who cut grass in South Africa imported from Spain. We strongly believe that this draft RP will induce mass retrenchments of permanent jobs in the mining sector, thermal power generation, value chain, throughout advocating decommissioning of coal stations when there is end of life cycle. It's a very interesting part that to build a power station, you require EIAs, you require water licenses, you require basically a lot of infrastructure that needs, that takes over 5 years to prepare for you to build a power station. Some of us are going to decommission. Then our understanding is, how do you then all of a sudden just take away the power station when there is end of life cycle without replacing it with another one of the same quality? Because we are not paying enough for the infrastructure that you put in there over the number of years. The very touchy issue I want to touch on is the least cost model that has been playing around by all of the energy analysts. They say, no, we're coming, one kind of draft RP is that we're bringing the least cost model, the renewables are the least cost. I have to tell you a very interesting sense of that the people who have designed this least cost model is called Plexus. It's now utilized, it's adopted by DOE, ESCOM, and NERSA. The people who have designed this system use the state resources based at CSIR to develop with our own money to take our own SOE out of the market. Reason they're doing that is to make sure all inputs come to Plexus system, make sure they favor all the renewables, and we want, we'll take the recommendation that it needs to be reviewed. What inputs are they putting in? It's like, how can you have an input of nuclear when the nuclear guys have not bid it? So the bidding price coming from EPRI, is an electrical power research institute, that literally takes models all over the world on indices that you use in electricity to model. But they use that, companies have evolved. They want to bid and say, give me an opportunity to bid. If my bid is bad, all what we did in Cape Town in the Cochrane said, no, the price was high. We dropped this because of the high price. How can we determine the high price before the bidding process? This cost we're talking about neglects one thing, very many things. South Africa has got over 54% of our youth unemployed. If unemployment is not part of the inputs of a Plexus, God forbid, it's not for South Africa. They can use it somewhere else. The second part is that the people, the individuals who designed the Plexus system, interestingly so, when we saw in April, Honorable Jeff Hardy was signing the 27 IPPs, the person who was in charge of the Plexus system, he has now jumped ship to become an entrepreneur on the other side. So it means he used our state resources to influence the government to buy what he his own personal company that getting billions on the other side. Just to finish off on the least cost modeling, it, the things that it doesn't take into account of, the life cycle cost. You cannot compare a solar plant that only runs for 20 years to a nuclear plant that runs for 70 years. So in that instance, it means the least cost, if it doesn't take account of that, it means the cost itself is literally incorrect. And the cost of wheeling to Eskom, when they build this solar plant, they don't pay for the infrastructure for Eskom taking it to a customer. So if they put their least cost model correctly, they should have included in the cost how much it costs me to basically put power from my IPP all the way down to a consumer. That is why Eskom is buying today, is being killed by buying renewable energy at 2.22 per kilowatt hour, selling it to the consumer at 1 rand. How do you expect Eskom to survive? Mm. Okay. I'm still talking to the draft RP. I will talk about what it means.
What are you caucusing about? Can you hear the outcome of the caucus?
So you must ask about my slides, the relevance on my slides.
Oh, okay.
We've been told since 2011 that the cost of renewables are coming down every single year. But the only proof we have at Eskom is an annual financial statement. Annual financial statements of Eskom 2016-2017 say Eskom pays 188 on average for all renewables that's paying there. In 2017-2018, Eskom is paying 2.22. To me, that's an increment of 18% that's even above inflation. So I want to know, where does this concept of saying it's coming down on RP? It is not. We've just had recently from Department of Energy presentations that on this RP, I asked, where is storage going forward? Because you're putting renewables in here. And you can see the renewables on column 4 and 5, there's plenty of them. Renewables cannot survive on their own if they're dispatchable without storage. I was told a very interesting story, that on embedded generation, they are hiding somewhere there. And there was a press statement, where DOE told us that there are other inputs here, sources that are called proxies of other technologies that have been mentioned yet. I can't believe we can put in our plan. A proxy is somebody who stands up for you when you can't stand for yourself. So it means what technology something that we put in our plan of our country, they don't even know who they are, some are called proxies. And that coming from a DOE is really embarrassing, to be honest with you. Gas and hydro. It says here, it's a lot. If you look at the size of gas and hydro, it's 11.9 gigawatts. It said it's going to be imported from Mozambique. All those gas deposits are owned by foreign companies. We do not even have an agreement with Mozambique, because we have had Cahora Bassa. When our government and Mozambican government at some stage had a bad relationship with Mozambique, we stopped buying from Cahora Bassa. So it means those are dependent solely on the relationship we have. That can't be put on in such a high number of 11.9 gigawatts on gas. The another important point is, you look at this RP, everything that I see here is owned in Europe. Gas is owned in Europe. It's owned in Mozambique now by the Americans. Water is owned by the Congolese. The renewables are owned by Germans and Spaniards. Which country in the world have you ever seen that actually outsources its own sovereignty by outsourcing its energy sources? Last but not least on this RP, interestingly, is it's meant to be an update. An update refers to the first part. We've seen 2010-2030 IRP update. It was updated in 2018. There is no resemblance on the two, as if the energy policy has changed. Unless the government tells us that energy policy, dropping nuclear completely, is that a policy, or the economic impact that made nuclear and coal to be shunned up completely up until 2030. There's a lot of questions that we see in there. I'll try, as I said, to compare it with the 2010. The biggest issue of what we've seen here is 30% drop on the 2018. They dropped 30% coal. They dropped 90% of nuclear. They've increased 20% of gas and diesel. To me, to us as experts in this field, it says, where is the rationale? Put the rationale on top so you can see exactly. Well, it can't be an update that talks to itself as if it's not related to 2010. Our RP that we profess, we literally called it a people's RP for the reason that it had inputs from lots of people from walks of life, from a man on the street up until professors and energy experts. Because it embraces transparent assumptions, security of supply, transformational agenda, developmental agenda, a wider consultative process, socio-economic and political issues, full utilization of SA resources, including its human capital, instead of retrenching it, competitive advantage that you want to use, not only the least cost that was applied in 2018. This issue of the least cost, I would issue the Department of Energy and the Ministry to basically review what did they mean by least cost. If you look at it, it doesn't go to 2030. It goes to 2050. 2050 for the reason that technologies evolve in different times. You can't, in 11 years, to build up a nuclear power plant and capability, it needs probably 8 years for it to become mature and have everybody else take advantage, companies have to take advantage of that opportunity. That's why if you look at even on ours, coal, immediately from on the first column, we immediately included coal from 2019 up until 2024. The reason for doing that is that our coal projects are reaching the end of life cycle. Our intention is not to close them, but replace them with an equivalent cleaner coal technology that basically replaces that up until 2025. On the nuclear, our people's RP takes cognizance of the fact that not all South Africans are empowered, don't even know what the best in the world, those South Africans are empowered to interact as companies, as entrepreneurs in the nuclear space, that we can start, confidence say by 2030 we should have built up a network, accreditations of international standards of making onto a nuclear spec of the new nuclear technologies. And if you look at how aggressive we are on this, it took literally the new capacity 29,000 till 2050. That says to us, we are aggressive, and we are using what we have to be aggressive on our technologies. Basically, its criteria. Okay. The next criteria is storage, which wasn't available on the draft IRP. Ours says we acknowledge the fact we are inducing more renewables into the system. So it means it is an imperative, that governs all international generators, that you must have at least 5 to 10% storage for every generating capacity that you make. Hence our 1,500 in there. PVs and wind, we are not against PVs and wind. They are still there as they are. And the gas, we have half gas for the reason that we do have gas in South Africa coming from shale gas. We do have CBM, coal bed methane, with underground coal gasification that is still under development. And if you look at it starting from 2028, we would have basically been in a position to give the country what it was. And the interesting part with coal, the last one, is that coal, we cannot all of a sudden make coal and say it is dirty. Well, there's been greater strides in the number of years to make coal to be clean. There's a coal called clean coal technology called HELE, which is high efficiency, low emission coal. And we need to embrace that because coal is part of ours. And this, we cannot actually overnight claim that coal is dirty in our part. On water, which is on hydro, we acknowledge the fact that South Africa is a water scarce country. So it means only the limitation will be on the small hydro picking plants. But at the same time, the INGA, unless the political climate between us and the other intermediate countries is okay, then we can. That is why, if you look at even the numbers that you put in there for hydro, is still meet 2030, fix up our political problems with them, and have 2,500 megawatts. On solar, which is the intermittent sources, I know we put them in there again. We acknowledge the fact that they've got a very important supplementary role to play in South Africa. South Africa is a huge 24-hour intensive economy that cannot be driven by intermittent sources. So, but we believe there's a role of wind and solar in many industries, like light industrial, residential, commercial and retail sectors that do not require a 24-hour firm supply to basically like the manufacturing industry. So it means so long as they come in at preferable low prices and are competitive and are manufactured locally. Lastly, on describing our people's IPP, what we did, people are asking, what 2050, we're talking 130 gigawatts. That's a very aggressive strategy. But we try to compare South Africa with world competitors, which is Australia, which mines a lot, and South Korea, which does a lot of production. Interestingly, South Korea in 1997 had the same amount of power, same as South Africa, same population. Today, South Korea has got power four times than South Africa because they increased the production to the level that we think South Africa should take that route because we can do a beneficiation increase employment in our country. And we believe this is achievable. As a recommendation for us, here is our table that literally tells us that by 2050, we're looking at 130 gigawatts of total power, and the percentage is in between. In 2050, would have been renewable plus gas at 26.75%, and hydro and storage on its own 6.9, coal at 42%, and nuclear at 23%, which we believe is a very healthy mix. That is not literally there to basically play down the role of renewables in our energy mix. In conclusion, we want to leave it upon to you, being esteemed politicians of our country, to basically lead us on this, on our understanding, being engineers who are basically saying as lowly engineers in the country, but who have an understanding of this, that we need to include Eskom in every energy decision instead of imposing decisions to Eskom. We need urgently to save Eskom that cannot afford renewable IPPs as we speak. As I'm telling you, they're buying power at 2.22, selling it at 1 rand. This loss is an intentional loss because we signed IPPs over the last 4 years, but we're paying the same price that we had in 2011. That's something you never see in gas. In gas, you never pay the price of petrol that was there in 2011. You pay what we call a spot price. So we need to reconfigure this IPP contract. It's possible. Ontario last week in Canada, they literally scrapped all 700 IPPs to save their own base load power. We need to review to a spot price which they claim, like 67 kilowatt hour, and say, oh, well, we're not chasing away other IPPs, but let them renegotiate the current price of what they're costing us today in the country. Because right now, we are passing through this cost to a consumer and Eskom on a sunk cost that is supposed to be borne by the developer. We need, on our recommendations, we need local manufacture of minimum 51%. And because these contracts are huge, they have to stimulate industrialization. We need to have an ITP offset trigger for all of these contracts, same as what we did with the armament contract in 2011. Everybody who gets a contract must have an obligation to create an industry in South Africa of equivalent amount of what has been spent on him. To make life easy for renewables, I think people feel we're being hard on it. I'll have a very light-hearted example. If somebody wants a free-range chicken, he goes to Woolies, if he believes it's healthy. It does not take everybody else to go buy a Woolies, the chicken, when people say, I'm okay with the one that gets it. So if they believe they can do the clean technologies, they've got a right, social rights, to basically build their own power plants, get a willing agreement with Eskom and supply to their own, because they believe their business case is positive. Then why didn't the government sovereign guarantees if basically your business case was positive? I think the last one is that I think we should stop politicizing energy sources.
How many last ones do we have?
the last one. We should stop politicizing energy sources and use them as internal fights, because this hurts the economy badly. If all goes badly, I think the best, because the economy electricity affects anyone. We have looked, talked to the communities out there. They say, can we then have something like Brexit? Democratically saying, those who want clean electricity, one side. Those don't, who feel I'm okay with this one at the lowest price, this one coming at half price, then let's make a democratic right to basically vote.
What's going on? This side is leading the clapping. Okay. Let me let Council and South African Energy Forum. Thank you very much. The last presentation will be from the Fossil Fuel Foundation. Look, you see what Honorable Fogo is doing there. We don't have time. Okay. Thanks, Honorable. Please. Fossil Fuel Foundation. I've been very generous to everybody, so I'm sorry you are the last one, so I've got to do this to you. Today is the fifth day. I know that you support many other people who spoke before here. We want to hear your recommendations.
Good day, Chairperson. My presentation is more about the value of coal in the country. We prepared this presentation so that we can put down the facts when it comes to coal in South Africa. So I believe I won't take too much of your time. I'll try to be short in doing this presentation. My name is Dr. Nandumalo Mbazo. I am currently based at the Council of Geoscience, but then I'm a council member for Fossil Fuel Foundation. And with me, I've got Professor Rosemary Falcon, which is a director for Fossil Fuel Foundation and a retired professor from West University. And next to her is Mr. Lionel Falcon, which is the founder for Fossil Fuel Foundation. An introduction on Fossil Fuel Foundation. Fossil Fuel Foundation is an independent and impartial non-profit making organization which has got board members and a board of trustees and executive committee and council members. The vision for Fossil Fuel Foundation is to be an efficient, informed stakeholder forum involved in the South African coal, gas, and associated energy resources and the industry into which they are sold. Then the mission of Fossil Fuel Foundation is to promote the state-of-art knowledge in Southern African resources, which are coal, gas, and any associated energy sources, and to also support capacity building, research, and skills development in all the sectors that I've mentioned already. The purpose of this presentation then is to actually lobby in the national interest the coal resource for secure energy and electricity plan as supported by government, industry and other committed parties by ensuring that we have energy security of the country which is reliable and sustainable in the short, medium, and long-term, to have adequate consistent, reliable, affordable, and secure supply of quality of power, to have an industrial growth, poverty eradication, job creation, and socio-economic development, as the other speakers have alluded on this, that coal can actually do this, and to have coal to be retained as a clean and sustainable part of the short to medium energy mix while the country is trying to move to a low carbon economy. On the next slide, this is the fossil fuel distribution in Africa, in the continent. As you can see that coal is abundant in the country, which is in the Southern African region in South Africa. And then gas and oil, it's mostly abundant in the north of the continent. Coal distribution in South Africa, currently we have, the country has got 18 coal fields in the country, and with this map that I've shown, you can see that with the dots, the red dots, it's active coal mines, and then the green dots, it's abandoned coal mines, which some of them, they can still be mined by small miners. But the point that I want to take home with this map is the fact that if you can look at the gray area is not tapped. That's why at the end of the day, the country still has got 66 billion tons of coal reserves which are left. And also, looking at the statistics that were produced by the Chamber of Mines, which is now the MINCOSA, the country is actually producing 263 million tons of coal, and Eskom utilizes plus minus 125 million tons of coal, which is almost 48% of the coal that is produced in the country. And then the remainder, it goes to other uses, it goes to exports, it goes to metallurgical usage. What type of coal do we have in the country? We have a high ash coal. What do I mean that when I'm saying we've got a coal that contains high ash? It has got high mineral matter. That's the type of coal that is left in the country. So we've got legal coal or very legal coal which has got less than 20% of ash. The coal that we have, it has got 35% and more of ash. So those are the 66 billion tons of reserves that we have. But irrespective of the type of coal that we have in the country, that type of coal can be still utilized when you apply clean coal technologies such as circulating fluidized bed combustion units. Looking at the relevance of coal in South Africa, as we all know that coal is the highest foreign exchange earning for SA. Actually, we have 50 billion. We gain 50 billion just by exporting coal. For local sales plus exports, we have 120 billion tons. That was 2017. And then that's why coal then end up being the largest mining income earner for the country. The country produces more than 91% of South African energy is produced from coal. More than 100% of carbon reductant in the metallurgical industry, that is whereby you are making steel, is from coal. More than 33% of liquid fuels, meaning your petrols, your diesels, and your paraffins, they are from coal. More than 200 major chemicals for over 7,000 of carbon-based products, they are from coal. That means your paint and all the other chemical products that you get, they are from coal. The relevance of coal in South Africa, looking at the socio-economic factors, coal is actually providing 255,000 direct employment in the coal mining space. which also included the coal power generation, sulfur metallurgical industries, and over 6,000 coal-fired factories in the country. That means the small boilers, like your hospitals, they are making their own electricity from coal. And then your major coal mines, they do support your social services, which are then on your social labor plans when it comes to mining. Coal industry, it actually supports major mining towns, which are Mpumalanga, Limpopo, and KZN, as I've shown in that slide, whereby I've got the map on. And then this slide shows the actual value chain of coal, as I've mentioned with the statistics that I've just shown. So you've got your primary sector, you have your secondary sector, and then you have your tertiary sector. Those are three different sectors that coal is involved in. Your primary is your exploration, your mining, and then thereafter your beneficiation. That's your primary sector. In that sector, we need electricity. And that's the most sector that utilizes electricity. So therefore, you need intensive and reliable electricity on the primary sector. Same goes for the secondary sector, whereby then you convert your coal into various products. We also need your intensive and reliable electricity usage. And then you have your coal on your tertiary sector, whereby you are using the products of coal, like your ash, as fertilizers. So that slide, it actually shows that we actually need coal. We actually need the base load. Our base load resource is coal, because the country is, as other speakers have mentioned, that the country, we're an industrialized country. We actually, that's where we make most, that's where we generate income for our GDP. So meaning that the mining sector for coal is the most highly, it's the most industry that we actually earn income from as a country. And then looking at the environmental issues associated with coal, the world CO2 emissions by country, South Africa is responsible for 1.1% of the total global CO2 emissions as compared to other countries. But then the country has committed that we need to reduce emissions by 35% and 42% within the next coming 8 years, whereas the other countries that are emitting CO2 more than South Africa, they have not committed to such. So we should be asking ourselves a question as to why did we make such commitments, whereas we are the least country that produces CO2 emissions. When it comes to coal usage or coal process, how can we reduce the CO2 that is emitted when you are processing your coal? If you can look at the slide that we have a program that was also mentioned earlier, which is a HELE program. It's a high efficiency and low emission program. What do I mean when I say a high efficiency and low emission program? If you can look at the slide, you've got your efficiency increasing, and then you've got the tonnages of your CO2 increasing, going up. And then looking at Eskom is actually on 34% as compared to the world average, which is 30% of its efficiency. The world average is 30%, and then Eskom is actually at 34%, which then it shows that Eskom is actually doing better than what the world is actually doing when it comes to efficiency. And then when it comes to emitting CO2, Eskom is emitting 1% of CO2 as compared to the world average of CO2 that is being emitted. So what the world then did was that in order for us to cut emissions, we need to embark on something that is called CCS, carbon capture and storage. But then the country doesn't have enough storage capacity, geological storage capacity for such. So how can we then reduce the CO2 that is being emitted in the country? We can do such by the introduction of clean coal technologies, like your advanced supercritical technologies, which can reach an efficiency of 50% whilst emitting 0.67 of CO2. But then the country hasn't, we have started with such, but then it's, I think the implementation or the execution programs that we have when it comes to reducing CO2 using, reducing CO2 that is produced from coal power plants is still not sufficient enough. Up until such time, we manage to introduce coal power plants that can, that goes, that are under, that are supercritical or advanced supercritical. This is an example of a coal power plant in South Korea. South Korea has got this power plant that has got a net plant efficiency of 42.4%. This power plant can actually, it can meet the standard, the stringent emission standards which are set worldwide, meaning that it doesn't need a back, it doesn't need a back-end desulfurization equipment to capture your sulfur oxide which are produced. And then in Kenya, this is an African example that we have, which is it's here in Kenya. In Kenya, you have a clean coal power station which has got also the highest efficiency in the world of up to 49%. It reduces your SOx, your NOx, and particulate matter at greater than 99%. It lowers your CO2 that is being emitted. It is below emission standards when it comes to the World Bank and your OECD. It is the lowest non-subsidized tariff in the country at 7.1 kilowatt per kilowatt. It reduces power generation of cost by 12 to 36%. And also, it will provide 30% of Kenya's country power and also extensive employment. It's highly flexible. It's similar to plants that are in Germany, in Malaysia, and also in Dubai. We have a challenge, the new challenge. The new challenge is we have our coal-fired power plants and we're trying to introduce wind and solar. Wind and solar can only operate about 30% of the time. As other speakers have mentioned, every kilowatt is required to be backed up by a baseload power. If we are a country that wants to use wind and solar, we need a baseload power that can back up such. So a proposal can be to co-supply wind and power to power stations, but then there are consequences that are related to such. Such consequences, you will have challenges when it comes to your currently installed fleet of coal power boilers. You'll have issues when it comes because your power boilers, your boilers will actually, you'll find a way of how then to switch from your renewable energy to your coal, from your coal to energy as well as from to your renewables. Also, the materials in the boilers, they are not used to such the type of power, meaning from your wind and solar, meaning that the, you will have issues when it comes to boiler flame out and ignition, the cost when it comes to ignition technology, and also those boilers will need greater care because now you are trying to mix two energies, which they do not support each other. So such challenges, they require renovation or rebuilding or redesigning of the existing coal-fired boilers, but then it will come at a cost. The advantages of coal, I think I will just pass through this slide, as many of the speakers have alluded to this, and also in my earlier in my presentation. And then going to the IRP then, you have your levelized cost of electricity generation, which is your LCOE. GE have run a preliminary model for LCOE based on the assumption on the draft IRP and also reference to coal-fired power plants which are on the African region, which they have installed. And the outcome they came about to that Kyberos coal in the IRP is overpriced by 21%. Circulating fluoride bed with FGD is also being overpriced by almost 24%. So the assumptions in the IRP to 2018 led to incorrect pricing of coal on the least cost basis, as well as estimates. The estimates that are used on the IRP, they are conservative, and the LOC is up to, the LCOE is up to 40% lower than the April report, as well as further investigations, they are required in this regard. And also, FFF is also recommending that IRP should consider using a more practical data when it comes to modeling their studies, because the data that they have used, it doesn't consider cost-benefit analysis. Going to levelized cost of electricity session 2, if you can look at the diagram that I have from the EIA, the IEA on Clean Coal Center, you can see that when you look at your coal and you look at coal plus biomass, with increasing biomass from 10% to 100%, and also looking at your gas and your wind and solar. Wind and solar, they become so expensive. Why are they expensive? It's because of they have a short lifespan as compared to your coal and your gas. So your coal has got the coal-fired boilers have got a lifespan of 40 up until 60%. That's one advantage, whereas wind and solar is 12 to a maximum of 20 years. Then after 20 years, you have to reintroduce again. So that's one reason. And then also, the reason why then coal is also, it becomes less expensive, it's because in South Africa, this is where we mine coal. So actually, the price of coal, the price of electricity generated from coal is actually cheaper as compared to the price of electricity generated from wind and solar, because from wind and solar we have to import the raw materials. We are not making it in the country. So they have to come from Germany or whichever country that they will be manufacturing. And what we can do in the country is to just do construction as the speakers have alluded. And going forward, then, if you look at this levelized cost of electricity generation with carbon tax, you can see that still, even though wind and solar becomes cheaper, but it's still expensive as compared to your coal, as well as coal plus biomass, and as well as gas. So, in summary, what are we saying? In summary, clean coal technology is leading to low carbon dioxide and low zero greenhouse gases emissions. They include ultra-critical plants, they include super ultra-critical plants or advanced ultra-critical plants. What do I mean when I'm saying the ultra-critical plants? It means we need to have power plants that can have the highest efficiency so that we can then be able to reduce the CO2 emission that is being emitted when it comes to the usage of these coal power plants. So in doing so then, such clean coal technologies can then, they can provide a reliable, practical, affordable, and environmental responsible solutions to mitigate to the future of coal in South Africa and to address energy, water, and waste trilemma that the country has. So items to be fully considered in the IRP, we need to consider the cost implications of reducing coal usage, meaning that if we are reducing coal usage, we'll reduce the amount of commodities that we're actually exporting, which will then reduce our foreign exchange and also gross GDP income. We need to cost out all the implications of adjusting boilers for flexible ramping, meaning that the switch from electricity generated from coal to the electricity generated from renewable energy. We also need to ensure that the baseload power for the country on a secure and reliable basis, including adding coal-fired circulating fluidized bed IPPs and ESCOM retrofits, meaning that the old power plants, the ESCOM old power plants can be retrofitted. So we really do not have to close them down, but then we can introduce technology that we can retrofit them and they can sort of emit less CO2. We also need to ensure that there's a need and availability of coal for heat, power and carbon, as I've shown you the whole coal value chain. That coal is not only for electricity generation, but also it's also included in your chemical production as well as in the metallurgical industry. So we also need to evaluate the level cost of electricity given the benefits of the circulating fluidized bed. And we need to further scrutinize the CSIR calculations which are used in the IRP document. We need to also ensure that South Africa joins the rest of the industrially developing world in using the best, most appropriate mix in technology and all primary energy sources which are embedded in the country like coal wisely for the benefit of all. So in conclusion, contrary to the popular belief that coal is dead, South Africa coal resources, as you have seen on the map, that we have abundant coal resources in the country. All that we need, the government needs to actually invest in a, it needs to invest in a low emitting CO2 technology, like your clean coal technology, like your circulating fluidized bed, so that we can actually improve the efficiency that the technology will produce, so that we can also, because that particular technology can also utilize your municipal, it can also, you can actually inject on that particular technology your municipal waste, you can also inject your the high ash coal that we have in the country. So thereby then we can also reduce your SOx and your NOx that are emitted. So the recommendations that we are making on the draft IRP are, the document actually needs an intense review, which can include all, or it can detail all energy sources that the currently has. We need appropriate experts appointed to undertake such relevant studies. We are also proposing that the 10-year plan recommended by the National Development Act be adopted within 2-year reviews in order for us to enable future energy plans for the country and to remain appropriate and relevant, suitable and secure. We need serious scenario planning undertaken in order to assess and adjudicate the relevant risk in the IRP 2018. And also in-depth calculations, which will also include your cost-benefit analysis. We need to consider them. And also we need a realistic data, not a theoretical data that is used on the IRP document. We need a realistic data, a data from the mining industry, a data from, we need actually to consider getting the actual data for electricity usage from intensive users as well as from the domestic side. So in summary, the Fossil Fuel Foundation key points are, we feel that the draft IRP 2018, it covers wind and solar renewable energies in an extraordinary detail with little or nothing on the other energy resources. We feel that the IRP 2018 concentrates on low-cost matters but fails to include cost-benefit options. We also feel that we also need to consider the realities that were encountered in other countries when it comes to wind and solar, as other speakers have mentioned, like in Germany. We also need to post-promulgation, the draft IRP as it stands, it has got many omissions and it's unbalanced in its review, and it's likely to lead to costly and serious unintended consequences if adopted as is. So that's why then at the end of the day we would like to have an intensive reviewal of the document post-promulgation. Thank you.
Thank you. We have come to the end of the presentation. We are running very late, but I didn't want to stop anyone. So at this stage, I will adjourn the meeting until next Tuesday when we have another session with people that we've invited to come to our round table. So you can travel safely home. Honorable members, thanks for staying late on a Friday. Yeah, I know you're still going to work.